Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 128 of Dominaria's Judgment, a mostly weekly, mostly constructed magic podcast. I'm Dom Harvey. I'm here with Ari Lex, and we are back to try and uncover what exactly is going on here with the murders at Karloff Manor. I have a few suspects in my mind, but I think I'm as much in the dark here as anybody else, even though they did, as far as I can tell, effectively spoil the outcome midway during spoiler season.
I'm still trying to figure out who died, but I do know who killed them. That's as far as I've gotten.
Well, there is still a mystery there to uncover, so we'll dial up Scooby-Doo and see if they can shed any light on things.
Yeah, so having had a bit of time to digest the set, what are your overall impressions of it? Because I like it more and more the more I look at it, but I don't know exactly why.
It's not really stirring any strong emotions in me, really. I've seen it described as, oh, they finally figured out how to do a new Capenna set. They just had to set it on Ravnica, which I think basically sums up my attitude to it as well. And just looking over the list of cards here, there's a lot of good, just kind of generic fair cards, role players, stuff like that, which I'm sure we'll find homes somewhere. And then there are, frankly, a lot of these weirdo build-arounds, which I'm excited to see people tweet out decklists with, and I'm sure Spike is going to have a blast just building decks around all of this new stuff. How much of that will actually stick, I'm a lot less confident on. But there's nothing which I think is an absolute slam dunk to show up in any of the older formats necessarily, but also I think there's enough to keep people occupied for quite a while here. So I think that's a good mix of stuff, but it would not shock me if in a year or two the set is almost entirely forgettable for me.
Yeah, and we'll probably dive into this right away when we start talking about like what our favorite card is, but I do think that there's a lot of stuff where there's a lot of individual designs that are forgettable, but the set as a whole is pretty cool. I like some of the stuff, like, as much as the joke of, like, it's not a Ravnica set, JK, here's Lightning Helix, and, like, the set is also just, like, there's 10 dual lands and a million gold cards. It's also decidedly not a Ravnica set somehow. It's very confusing. Also, your sentiment about New Capenna, I think, speaks more to not really understanding why New Capenna exists, and less to this set existing in the first place.
Yeah, I think some kind of sinister world consumed by murders or whatever, and everyone's trying to figure out exactly what the hell is going on before they become the next victim themselves. That's kind of a cool premise for a set, but I think the world building and everything you do to flesh it out needs to be on point too, and that's, I guess, much easier when you can paint by numbers using some of the reliable hits from Ravnica, as opposed to having to build a whole new world from whole cloth, and you're trying to do this three color thing, which is sorely needed. And if you actually had a set which did what, you know, Alara tried to do and couldn't, but even that was 15 years ago, if New Capenna had succeeded in that fairly ambitious aim, then that could have been an all-timer of a set. Instead, it just kind of flopped on every single one of those metrics, and so this set, much less ambitious, and it shows, but I think much more successful in that, you know, lower ambition, and that shows as well.
Yeah, well, I think it harkens back to, like, a lot of what we saw during the 2016 to 2018 era, where it felt... So, this... I'm trying to think of what the exact flip was between that era and the later one, but it felt like they were trying to build a setting with the cards more than build cards that were highlights of the setting. Like, you see a lot in, like... Theros Beyond Death, it feels like they went the sort of, I don't know, it's kind of hard to compare, like, Kroxa to some of the, like, more thematic build arounds from Amonkhet and Eldritch Moon, but it may also be that, like, a lot of the, and this may also have to do with how they split cards into commander, so just kind of build this up, like, a lot of the, like, very iconic stuff in, like, Theros and Wilds of Eldraine is, like, we have a very specific, well-known thing that we are building a card for, and it gets pushed to hell, and that was the problem. It's with the context of, like, Eldritch Moon or Amonkhet, I don't think there were quite as many, like, high-key iconic things that they were trying to hit with a specific card that got pushed. And it was more like the general ambiance of, like, how things came together. And that's what this set sort of feels like, with the exception of, like, 20 cards in the commander decks that are just like, this is the Scooby-Doo card, and this apparently I think one of them is like I forget which anime it is, which is, it's not Death Note, I think, but it's a different detective anime. And it's like a clear reference to it.
Yeah, I think that it almost gets easier to really fully commit to this kind of theme when you put it in a setting where you've already explored basically everything that is new or native to that setting in the first place. So if you put this set, if you like, on an entirely new world, then there's going to be some tension between exploring the thematic stuff about this murder mystery and exploring, ideally, what you want to explore about this new world to introduce to people. We've seen, I would say, basically everything there is to see on Ravnica, so the only way that changes is if you put something entirely new there, and then that new thing can become the focus. And Ravnica is just a reliable hit with the audience at large. So there might actually be like a very smart tactical choice is to put it on a setting like that, even if at a first glance it is low-hanging fruit as well.
Yeah, well, also, you're talking about Ravnica being overexplored. The easy way to have something new the next time you see it is have a reason to kill a bunch of characters like they did. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, and the mechanics here really lean almost too hard on the flavor as well. So investigate as this kind of core mechanic of the set, like, okay, once you call it investigate, that kind of writes itself. But then also collecting evidence and all of this other stuff, which it's almost a case study in what you can do when you really commit to that marriage of theme and mechanics. And they aren't that adventurous with it, really, in this set. So it's not a complete case study in how far you can go. But as an example of a pretty simple template to follow in the future, perhaps, given that we're going to be churning out so many sets every year, you can imagine this being a more important, like a historical moment in a few years from now as well.
Yeah, that all makes sense. Overall, I think this set is one of my like favorites looking at the spoiler of the last few years. So yeah, big fan of what's in it, even if it's hard to point to like specific cards that I'm like, oh, this is a great card that I'm really excited by. I'm excited by the set, and like the cards in general are good vibes.
Yeah, so I think the way we want to break this up is we do want to go via, you know, standard, modern, and pioneer, and then just miscellaneous slash other as a category too, noting the cards that we think are most likely to show up in each of those places, bearing in mind that all three of those official mainstream constructed formats will have a lot of eyes on them, and for good reason, in the next few weeks. So we have a round of modern RCs, where both for Denver and for Ottawa, that is the pre-release weekend for this set. So any cards there that are going to make a splash in modern, if you can figure it out in time, that might be one thing that does actually spice up what at this point has become a fairly established and stable slash stale format, however you prefer, and we'll get to that at the end here. And then with standard, you know, the RCQ season still in full swing there, and then of course the Pioneer Pro Tour, which only a few hundred of us have a reason to care about, but we have a lot to care about there with this set. So I'm going to explore the set's impact by format, but then I think more broadly there's also just this dividing line in the set between the reprints or the riffs on old cards, you know, not just actual Lightning Helix and actual Assassin's Trophy, but also, you know, Can't Believe It's Not Thraven Inspector, or now your Convoke deck gets to play with another playset of Thraven Inspectors. And then also there's stuff like, you know, No More Lies, which we don't have Mana Leak in Pioneer, and that's been this kind of glaring omission in the format for a long time. And now that is fixed in this very specific way. So a lot to dive into on that front. And then you have all of these weird combo cards, build around cards, things which will find a home somewhere, but will that be a reliable home in a top tier deck, or will it be one of these spike brews? Will it be this just like kind of casual FNM or for fun stream caliber deck? And then you have the fair cards and the more reliable role players, which they have a role to fill, but the question then becomes like, is that a role that needs filling, and will anyone really care about them all that much?
Yeah, so I guess let's get started on actual cards. I think just the easiest categories to start with are favorite and least favorite cards. I'll start off with my very subtle favorite card in the set, which is Reasonable Doubt. This is the Quench that suspects a creature. And this is the kind of card that just like looks extremely innocuous to me, but the more you think about it, it's like, oh, I think if you play this in like a reasonable number of mid-range shells, there are games where this effectively reads counter target spell, destroy target creature, or like counter a spell, your creature becomes unblockable. And I think that's just, like, a really weirdly powerful thing to have exist, but, like, not something that is immediately obvious when you just read This Is Quench.
Yeah, you could imagine in stuff like the Blue-White Soldiers decks in Pioneer, which now the Soldiers thing is more of a loose vibe than an actual tribal component. It's just Blue-White Flash with some bells and whistles on top of that. That kind of deck already has a lot of love for Make Disappear, and so it's directly competing with one of the best quenches that we've seen in a while, and the reason that's such a good quench is because it can be so much more than quench if you really need it to be, whereas this one can't. On the other hand, if you are that kind of aggro control deck, then yeah, either suspecting your own creature to give it the menace, you know, you could imagine your Knight Erin of Eos suddenly picks up menace and now is just effectively unblockable, or you remove their, you know, Glissa Sunslayer or something as a blocker, and now you can just attack in with complete abandon. Like, either one of those modes sounds pretty good to me. So yeah, if you can turn your counterspell into something more, especially one that cheap, then that's always appealing, and I think this one has pretty good odds of doing that. And then also, I imagine this will be a very impactful card in Limited, where just, you know, a quench by itself often is going to swing a race or be like a very big moment in the game. And then once again, either side of the, you know, rigging the combat math in this way is going to do a lot as well. So yeah, I expect to see a lot of blowouts involving this card in the very near future.
Yeah. So what do you have for favorite? It's currently sitting blank on the show notes because...
Yeah. So I hadn't filled this in yet. And part of that is I realized that my favorite card is listed as your least favorite card for some reason, and that's Aftermath Analyst. So this is the 1 energy, 1/3, which when it ETBs, you mill 3, and then you can pay 3 and G and sack it at instant speed to Splendid Reclamation. So you get all lands from your graveyard back into play tapped. And I love the Splendid Reclamation. Spent a lot of time trying to make various decks involving that card work, and having a self-enabling Splendid Reclamation on the card type, which often is better in terms of getting it back from the graveyard or just finding it in general in a color that's very good at doing that, this is really getting my creative juices flowing. So again, unsure if this is a casual slash cube thing that will keep me endlessly entertained, or if this is, you know, will I lose valuable PT testing time trying to build Aftermath Analyst decks in Pioneer? The answer probably is just yes to both, but it's the kind of card among the vast array of these weirdo build arounds in the set, this is the one that really gets me going. So to have you trying to trample my dreams already, you know, is a real difference of opinion.
Yeah, this is the card that exists. Like, I don't understand. Like, Splendid Reclamation is already, like, a very powerful effect that exists as its own thing. I don't understand why you need to make Splendid Reclamation +++. That's my problem with this card, is that it's, like, this is the most, like, 2021 design or late 2020 design, depending on exactly when you time it, of the entire set. And it just sort of stands out like a sore thumb to me, where it's just like, why do we need this? But apparently you have spent more time in the Splendid Reclamation mines than I have. And it's, like, clear to you that Reclamation isn't enough, but maybe this is right on the nose. So I could be wrong here.
I mean, if the idea of channeling Takanuma to get back your analyst and then playing your analyst and then, you know, returning 3 of the lands you just milled and 7 of the lands that you milled prior to that through various different means, if that doesn't get you going, then that's just a difference of species at that point. I don't know what to say.
Okay. I guess let's kick it along maybe to my, I don't know, this was the one that I wanted to put on, but I didn't really know how to qualify it because is it really in the set? And this is the new Tomic that, like, this is just, I said my piece with...
And this is your least favorite, to be
clear.
Yeah,
least favorite. So this is Tomic, Wielder of Law. It's a 1 white-black affinity for Planeswalkers, 2/4 flying vigilance. Whenever an opponent attacks with creatures, if 2 or more of those are attacking you or Planeswalkers you control, that opponent loses 3 life and you draw a card. But this card is only available in the pre-release kits and doesn't exist anywhere else. And, like, I don't know. I've been through one Nexus of Fate. I don't want to be through more. I thought they stopped this for a reason, and I'm just so over it. Like, can we just not?
Yeah, I mean, the game text on the card, Nexus of Fate, was multiply offensive in various different ways just by itself. This one is very tame. I mean, I didn't get the affinity for Planeswalkers thing at first, and then, you know, discovered the flavor reason for that, and it's like, okay, that's kind of cool, I guess, if you're in the know. in constructed Magic these days, like, planeswalkers are not such a big component that you care about, like, the Oath of Kaya style trinket text, which for my money is a good thing. But yeah, this is a mostly inoffensive card, but released to us in this reliably and repeatably offensive way. So yeah, just by default, any card like that is going to rustle some jimmies here and there. And yeah, I mean, if there is a legitimate demand for that one, then we're going to have that same kind of a news cycle and debate all over again.
Yeah, I again, the card text itself is not the offensive part. It's just the manner of production. There's this, like, slight honorable mention, but we'll get to that, because I think the next card on the list that I have as a whole is good. There's just a negative one thing about it that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. And then my least favorite, my easy first choice was Kaya Spirit's Justice. So this is the new 4-mana Oz of Kaya. And the text is as follows. Whenever one or more creatures you control and or creature cards in your graveyard are put into exile, you may choose a creature card from among them. Until end of turn, target token you control becomes a copy of it, except it has flying. The +2, you surveil 2, exile a card from your graveyard, or a graveyard. The +1 is you create a 1/1 black spirit token with flying. And then the -2 is exile target creature you control. For each other player, exile up to one target creature that player controls. So you see this formidable static ability that consumes 5 lines of text and has to be shrunk down to just even fit in the text box. And once you're done reading and passing that, you then have to figure out how it interacts with all of the fairly distinct and, like, fairly unconnected abilities, and then trying to add all that up. It's hard to tell if the card is more or less than the sum of its parts, or if the sum of its parts just as a baseline is even worth the psychic damage that reading it in the first place has inflicted upon
it. I'm going to be 100% honest. You read the text of the first ability on this card, and when I first read this card, I tried to, and then I just erased it from my brain and just assumed someone would later tell me how it actually works in a practical manner. And as you started reading it, just the filter came on and it's just gone. The other abilities are really good. There's some text on it that doesn't really matter, right? Like, it's just 3 abilities like a planeswalker.
Yeah, it's like someone took the maxim that reading the card explains the card as a personal affront to them and as a challenge. And so we get cards like this as a result, which I don't mind if planeswalkers are going to be this less central focus of each set. You're going to have, you know, 1%, one unique character, and so on. I think that trying to take those designs to these more experimental places is a good thing, by and large. Like, I don't think you want this, like, cookie cutter, paint by numbers style of planeswalker at that point. But there's a happy medium, I think, between that kind of overly simple design and whatever the hell this thing is. So if someone successfully makes this work, I will applaud them, not just for having done the usual, like, design process to get there, but also just for being willing to understand what the card is and successfully converting on that. So jury is out on that front, but just in terms of reading the card and whether that's a pleasurable experience, easy miss for me. And then in the same vein as that, there's Proft's Eidetic Memory. So this is a 1 and blue legendary enchantment. When it ETBs, you draw a card, you have no maximum hand size, and then at the beginning of combat on your turn, if you've drawn more than one card this turn, you put X +1/+1 counters on target creature you control, where X is the number of cards you've drawn this turn, -1. So it's not overly complicated once you actually go through all of those steps, but just the idea of we set up this condition, which the card kind of meets by itself initially, but then when it comes to implementing that condition, you have to, like, go back to a number which is below what the cutoff for that would have been in the first place. Like, the by far the most popular outcome for this card will be on the turn you play it, it draws you a card, and then you put one counter on a thing, which, like, mentally, you immediately jump to, oh, I've drawn 2 cards, I get 2 counters. That's not the case. And then the number of counters you do get is below what would have been the threshold if it was the case. So there's a lot of jumping back and forth to get it to what in the end is a pretty uninspiring outcome. And I will just wonder if there's a cleaner way that could have happened. Or if, frankly, like, if it's just the number of cards you've drawn this turn instead of -1, is that overly powerful? Like, almost certainly unlimited, yes. But I think if you're willing to sacrifice that on the altar of simplicity, then you get a much nicer design in the end.
I think that would still be too good for Constructed. Like, this would just be a Spectral Flight that drew a card and produced more Spectral Flights over time, right? I This card is in the same vein as the Green-White Legend from Lost Caverns of Ixalan, where you read the card like five times and you do not understand what it does, and then someone just like tells you some math and everything makes sense and you never have to worry about it again. Unlike Kaya, where like I don't know, you could tell me what it does and I really honestly would like be surprised that the creature retained exactly flying in like some weird case where like the order that it gains the abilities matters. I don't know. This one is just like you just put counters equal to the number of extra cards you've drawn, and someone says that, and then it's over. Like, you just know what happens.
So with that, you mentioned some other dishonorable mentions or other less or least favorites, which will come up in the course of our discussion here. But let's dive into some of the mechanics and some of the cards themselves. So thinking about collecting evidence here quickly. So you get collect evidence N, and that number N, you have to exile cards from your graveyard with combined mana value equal to or greater than that number. So there are a few standouts with that mechanic from the set. So Analyze the Pollen, Explain Ferox, and so on. And I like that you can kind of tweak the dials on the card here. So, you know, you could have a pretty easy collect evidence condition, you know, 3 to 4, something in that range. You could have something which is very high, like a 9 or a 10. Or you could have something which is variable along with however much you want to devote to it. So collect evidence X or something like that. And so you can have a bunch of designs with this mechanic, which, because they're at opposing ends of the spectrum or some variable place in between, don't actually feel like they're operating in the same space at all.
Yeah, it's such a weird mechanic, because I think that it's one that I'm going to have to sit down and play with to really grasp how difficult it is to get mana value in your graveyard, and like, also, how, like, there is going to be something with how the math on this adds up for, like, you have a collect evidence 6 card. How do you want to, like, sequence the things ending up in your graveyard so you are not having to exile, like, a 2, a 2, and a 3, and then have your next one come up short? Which is just, like, I don't really know how you're going to understand that without just physically playing with the cards there. Or, like, in the case of 10th District Hero, this is the, like, pseudo figure of Destiny. There's probably just like some weird deck building or order of operations consideration where like you need to make sure that the first thing that ends up in your graveyard is something that is cheap for the collect evidence too, so that you aren't wasting a larger collect evidence fuel later for the collect evidence 4 to become the like ultimate on it. Like that kind of stuff, it's a very weird mechanic. I am excited to play with it. There's a card that I think we don't have on the show notes that I just didn't really process until thinking about it in context of Limited, but I think, honestly, the one of these that I'm almost most excited about for Constructed is Extract a Confession. This is the edict that you can collect evidence 6 to turn into, like, a Crackling Doom-style edict where they sack their biggest thing. And this is just kind of this natural, like, it's a good 2-drop removal spell that scales into a, like, I sort of terror in the late game, but, like, it does it in a way where it's just, like, maximized for mid-range-ish mirrors where they might just have, like, this is their shelter on the battlefield. And now, some of this is going to be context where, like, yeah, this card is not great if your opponents are all on Siren's, Spyglass Siren, and I just, like, can see this card, though, in a lot of spots where it's just the most effective removal spell for the 2-drop roll in ways that a lot of the other options, like to the Long Goodbye from this set, just aren't, because there's not a card that necessarily, like, you know, this might be the closest thing to Heartless Act in a format, is kind of where I'm going.
Yeah, I do like a lot of the kind of limited uncommon level collect evidence designs where there's going to be some tension over how many of these can you afford to have in a deck together, and then, you know, you don't get to cheat the condition in pretty predictable ways, which is my main complaint with the mechanic that I'll circle back to in a second. And so if you mostly have to actually get these more expensive cards that can contribute to that single-handedly, if you have to get them in the bin the hard way, then there's a limit to how many of those you can play. And so actually balancing the ratios of collect evidence cards in your deck to how you expect to be meeting that condition and how often, like, I can see that actually being this really fascinating puzzle. My issue with it when it comes to Constructed, especially once you get into Modern in particular, is that it kind of, like almost all new mechanics these days, it it has either the Fetchland issue or the Up the Beanstalk issue, where in this case, with the Beanstalk issue, the best way to enable this is with cards where you never actually interact with the apparent sticker price. It's just, it's something that just bins itself naturally. So if I'm trying to use Analyze the Pollen in Modern, you know, the kind of Traverse the Uvenwald analog where it just searches for a basic for G as a sorcery, or if you collect Evidence 8, you can search for any creature or any land instead. The way I'm going to set that up, it's not going to be actually casting spells where the amount of mana that I cast for those adds up to 8 in any realistic timeline. Is going to be, I cycle my Generous End and then I untap and I cycle a Street Wraith and then I cast this and I'm there already. And what I've done is just kind of cheat the count, if you like, or I've evoked a Solitude, God forbid, or all this stuff, which like it just feels like voodoo accounting past a certain point. And we've seen all these tricks before. I don't think there's anything too new in that space with a card like this. So maybe this fits in decks where Traverse the Uvenwald wouldn't. But even with Traverse, you had some of the same issues at the time, right? Whereas in theory, the question of how do you balance this mix of card types and getting those in your graveyard early, that should be a more difficult problem than it was in a format where you can cycle Street Wraith and play Mistress Bauble and you always have a land in there because of fetch lands, and like when three quarters of it just kind of scripts itself, you don't feel any sense of achievement at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that specifically with Analyze Pollen, which at least in my mind is the only one of these cards that is likely to hit Modern and specifically the formats that have the, you know, pitch cast spells, is that that number is so big that it's like, okay, you put a Solitude in your graveyard, and then what? And it's the "and then what" on Analyze the Pollen that keeps me interested in the effect and make it... It's not like Up the Beanstalk where it's just like, I cast a Solitude and I get this. It's like, I've cast a Solitude, and then I also have to select my other cards in my deck in such a way that, like, they are pitchable to Solitude, but end up in my graveyard and all this other stuff. Because a lot of the cards in the most recent four-color decks aren't... they aren't selected for ending up in the graveyard. And that is, I mean, it was a bit of the puzzle with Traverse, but a lot of that was just kind of like, I don't know, we're going to like put an Abundant Growth on our fetch land and sacrifice it kind of stuff, which is not the most interesting when you have it with Yorion. But I guess like that's at least like the lowest level of extra effort that you're talking about trying to figure out when Analyze the Pollen is in a space where, like, I don't think, like, when you are talking about, like, oh, I've pitched a Solitude, like, you end up down a card on that exchange, and then, like, the next, like, three is a lot to cover the gap there, and, like, even with the Generous End, you're still talking about two there, and, like, it's, I think that there's an actual extra hurdle there beyond just, like, casting my free spell for free.
Yeah, I think the question that keeps that mostly hypothetical for me as a concern is, what are we finding with this when it comes to Modern? Because with Traverse, when you look at the shells that that card has shown up in, it's either these very low to the ground, like Shadow, Tarmogoyf style decks where being able to get those specific cards and having those still be good was a big part of that equation, or it's stuff like the four color Traverse decks where you had your one Emrakul for the super long games, or specific evoke creatures, or you could find the Baseju to pair with your Renesix and stuff like that. And I guess that set of applications is mostly still on the table. But I guess those decks, when it's this condition versus, you know, Delirium, where like I don't think you would want Mistress Bauble in a deck like this, for example. Like, I'm not sure exactly what you're finding. I think the most likely candidate would be some kind of Asmo and or Inti shell, where a lot of the cards that cycle themselves for free or at a low cost are the Street Wraith and the General Sense of the World and so on. And you know, maybe you find a room to get a spare Oval Chase Daredevil in the bin or something, and then that's halfway there. So maybe some kind of deck like that, just something which already wants to be cheating costs like that in a pretty big way. But outside of that, I don't know what the natural home for this would be.
Yeah, it is sort of weird. The problem that there might be involved there is that, like, one of the natural homes, it's like, what creature would I want to search for with this? It's like, well, what decks would want to search for a creature? And it immediately comes to mind some sort of weird reanimator shell, But the problem is that to do that, like, the thing you're going to exile that's expensive is already in your graveyard, so you already sort of accomplished that sub-goal. Like, yeah, I see what you mean about there not being a clear home for it, but I'm not quite seeing it all come together.
Yeah, and even in something like this hypothetical Asmo Inti deck, I mean, both of those creatures are very good when you're leaning into them, but I don't know if they're that good that you want to jump through all of these hoops to cast this tutor to get one of those a turn or two behind when you would naturally have it on curve anyway. And so unless there's also some additional thing that you can work into that mix, then I'm not sure it makes it across the line there. And then a lot of the like creature combo decks in Modern just fundamentally are not well placed to use these. And those are the kind of decks which have the most interest in, you know, I search for my Yawgmoth, my Heliod, whatever my namesake creature is. It's just pretty hard for this card to actually function in that context. So in that sense, it might be the perfect kind of enabler where it looks very enticing and you get your brain rowing with all of the things you can do to set it up or to profit from it, but that whole package just never really comes together in the end. Like, the danger isn't really there.
Yeah, so I guess moving past this card, I don't see a lot of other, you know, we mentioned the collective evidence cards that are interesting. I guess one more I want to mention for the context of Standard is I think that turn 4 Axebane Ferox is a problem. Just like that, I think that it is harder to collect evidence large number in a format unless you are really trying. And I think that the idea of Axebane Ferox is that you are expecting your opponents to not be trying at that extent because it's not naturally good for their deck. So like this thing just kind of rumbles in. There is a bit of a bad lineup with Preacher of the Schism where it's just like my big Death Touch thing runs into your slightly smaller Death Touch thing and it's all over. But yeah, that card is a lot for what it offers on turn 4. But it's basically, you know, not a card later in the game.
Yeah, that Death Touch pseudo mirror, if you like, is one reason why I don't think I'm as high on the Trostani as you are, which it may actually be the first kind of a Loxodon Smiter kind of riff that we've seen in a long time that actually makes it over the line. But I think one reason I'm skeptical is that so often, like, yeah, if it's in a heads up against Preacher or Shielded or something, then unless you have a full turn's worth of mana to sink into it, then you can't threaten to win that combat. And outside of that, you know, you do actually need a lot of bells and whistles on top of your 3-mana 4-4 for that to be a respectable stat line in this day and age. So I'll let you mount a defense of that one if you like, but I think some of the broader skepticism of cards like this kind of carries over to that one to me.
Oh, no, I'm also skeptical. Like, this, I don't want to say I'm high on this card. It just feels like it's the first one of these, like, this is a 3-mana 4-4 that goes right into the garbage. Like, this is the closest I think I've ever felt one of these is to good because of the combination of, like, how it can work in combat in a lot of spots. I think just the ability to double strike into an effective 8-power creature unanswered is the thing that got me, but it probably is not good because it is just a 3-mana 4-4 creature, no value, no, like, text that impacts the battlefield without expenditure of additional mana.
Yeah, I do think the mana cost is somewhat imposing for Standard right now as well, where it is flexible with like the weird kind of hybrid setup, but at the same time, like, what is the base green white deck that has an audience for a card like this? Like, you have all of these various black X mid-range decks, and Golgari is kind of the closest to a deck that would want a card like this, but is still pretty far off. And you just don't really have a green-based mid-rangey deck that wants some like slightly overstated and undercosted creatures. Like, maybe with enough cards like this, a deck like that can exist, but you do actually need to get to that critical mass first, and I don't think this gets you there.
Yeah, I'd be willing to believe. I mean, that was like a whole thing in Standard. It's like, one of the colors of this card is just unplayable for so long. Like, it's relatively unplayable now to begin with, so like, this is not going to make green cards playable in the format by itself, by any sort of margin.
Yeah, let's touch on some of the reprints or reprints-esque cards in the set here. So Lightning Helix making its return to Standard and its debut in Pioneer. Assassin's Trophy, which is easy to forget was in Pioneer in the first place, but I guess making its return debut to Pioneer and also joining Standard now. And then we have Novice Detective as Fabian Inspector 1 through 4 for Standard, or 5 through 8 for Modern, but specifically Pioneer as well, where if we want to start with Novice Detective, you know, Boris Convoke has been the talk of the town at several different points, and I think has very quickly like faded from view once people started caring about it or saw through that wave of hype. But I think the Thraven Inspector is a legitimately massive upgrade for that deck, because your Vordarian Epicure really isn't it, and even with Epicure, often just getting that raw density of targets for Gleeful Demolition was easier said than done. And so Thraven Inspector was already a great card in that deck, and I think you would just happily play more of them. I don't know what the actual cap would be, but it's probably more than 8, and so getting Inspector 5 through 8 is a really big deal there. That being said, even if that deck in the abstract gets a lot better, as we head into the Pioneer PT, where, you know, Blue-White is maybe the deck poised to gain most from this set and be, like, the big litmus test overall, that, classically, has been a pretty difficult matchup. And then stuff like the Amadio combo decks, which are a nightmare for what is just a interaction light all-in creature deck. Like, I don't think the deck's positioning is very good at all, but it's better at doing whatever it is it was doing in the first place.
Yeah, the thing that interests me the most about that card in Pioneer is the fact that it lets you cut another red card from the deck, which brings you down to, like, the stock list just having Recruiters, Demolitions as red cards in the main deck, which I think is better for the mana. I'm actually, on that note of mana, like, I don't care too much about what the 5th through 8th Thraven Inspectors do in Pioneer. I am interested to see what the impact on Standard is of this, because there's a weird tension where, like, this card in theory should be at its best with Gix and Rafine, but the mana for those cards is, like, not the best setup for a Thraven Inspector, just because of the nature of, like, the enemy colored lands that are good are the slow lands or ETB tapped lands, and they aren't the fast lands. So, like, it's kind of difficult to stitch together Gix and Novice Detective. And maybe you do it with Rafine, but then you have to shift your deck to be, like, more of a... maybe that's an overstatement, but it does incentivize you to shift your deck to be more of an Azorius deck. Like, this is the sort of the problem with trying to stitch together the, you know, you've got your blue and black one-drop flyers in your deck, and then all that happens whenever I see someone try to do that with Rafine is they just, like, play a one-drop and then play a tapped land and a one-drop on turn two, and it's like, why didn't you just play, like, a two-drop and a two-drop and have good mana. That's probably the issue that pops up there, but it feels like this card is enough more powerful than Fairy Dream Thief that it makes it worth reconsidering.
Yeah, I have seen some Esper lists with a much heavier white component with Amalia as a two-drop and the Ruin Lurker Bat at one, which I'm not going to issue a verdict on that whole package, but it is at least possible if you're willing to bend the mana around it to, you know, have a white one drop on one and then build out from there. I think the issue with Thraven Inspector in that context is a 1-2 body on the ground in Standard just gets obsoleted so quickly to the point where you can't reliably attack with it, even if you might be able to connive some counters onto it with Rafine, that you effectively are paying a lot for an Elvish Visionary, even if it's in installments. And when your Esper deck is firing on all cylinders, like, it has a lot of mana sinks, it's using all its mana each turn, and so the relative merit of a card like that just diminishes pretty quickly. I think it's a lot more interesting to me in either these heavy white aggro or tempo decks where you know, with Knight Errant of Eos, a card like that, you just want more good ones to power those early turns. We did actually have a Convoke deck, a Boros Convoke deck that we tested for Worlds, which we thought was only a card or two off, and Novice Inspector is a really nice pickup for that deck. And then there's also stuff like the more low to the ground white blue token style decks where a one drop package of Inspector, Spyglass Siren, and Warden of the First Sky, that's a really nice way to flesh it out, and then you can kind of go from there. So I think the card will be pretty important and pretty impactful. I think it's, you know, sometimes you have a reprint like this and all it tells you is how contextual that card's success was the first time and how it doesn't really hold up in modern Magic. I don't think that's true of Thraven Inspector by any means, but I think you do have to look a little harder to find the shells for it, and it doesn't just go in any white deck that moves.
Yeah, I guess on that note, I have some of the same concerns about Lightning Helix's impact in Pioneer, where, like, it feels like the card is clearly the right power level, but there isn't a red and white mana deck that wants to play that card.
Yeah, I'm sure, depending on how deranged Claudio's testing gets for the PC, I'm sure you'll see it show up in some five-color Niv list as, like, one of the actually good Boros cards that you can find, but if you're at the point where you are going third every game with a lot of tap lands and a lot of pain lands or shock lands in your mana base, and then you're hoping to claw some of that back with a card like Lightning Helix, don't know if that's really the best use for the card, but that said, like, where is the other Boros deck or, you know, three-color deck with Boros in it that could even entertain this idea? Like, I don't think that really exists, and I don't think this card is enough of a reason for it to exist. And even stuff like, I guess if you played old-school Boros Burn and Pioneer, which is plausible but not advisable, like, I guess Helix would slot into that deck. You could play it in some context in Convoke, but that's a deck which has very limited space for interaction as it is, and it needs all of that to do specific things. So yeah, like, it's a powerful card. I think it still has what it takes in, like, a very generic sense, but actually finding a deck to put it in is going to be much easier said than done.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Claudio deck, and I do want to just, like, caveat that discussion with, like, okay, let's talk about decks that people are actually going to play who are listening to this, and not just one person who will win a Magic Online challenge with it and then trick everyone else into playing their deck for one league.
Yes. There is stuff like the various four-color Omnath decks and so on, which could play this card, and, like, their mana is good enough for that, but I don't actually think it serves much of a role in those, because you already have a decent amount of life gain, you have other defensive tools, and you want the ones that you do have to do specific things, and so, like, often the cards which Helix is best at trading with, it does so either temporarily or not at all for the problems that you actually care about. And so, yeah, it can kill a Bloodtithe Harvester on turn two or something, but part of the, you know, one of the virtues of a deck like this is you mostly don't care about, like, the small ball creatures that a lot of the other decks do actually have to care about. So I guess if Smuggler's Copter is popular, then same deal. But so it could be a role player in something like that, but I will have to see it to believe it at this point.
Yeah, and we can just pretend that Assassin's Trophy doesn't exist, I think. It just wasn't good in Standard the last time. I don't see why it would have aged well.
Yeah, I mean, there are some Standard mana bases which have maybe one basic land, if that, like Esper or Slowgurk or some of these more adventurous decks. It is quite funny to me that the card is basically useless against the five-color ramp deck just because of how many basics it's kind of forced to play by default, but hypothetically, you could do what I think, like, Shota did for one of the MPL regular events, where just hard targeting those all dual land mana bases with some Mendic Assassin's Trophies, but it doesn't take much for that gamble to go very wrong very quickly. Like, your opponent just shows up with two basics and suddenly your entire deck is a lot worse. So yeah, I think that again is a lot more of a role player than just a, like, default limitless test removal spell. And the other thing about that too is the first time around, you know, when Assassin's Trophy was in Standard, there was a much more varied range of stuff which you really felt you had to hit. So various Planeswalkers, especially after War of the Spark. You had cards like Bolas the Citadel in the decks that had those. Like, a lot of things which conventional removal would not hit, and you needed to go to these drastic lengths sometimes. These days, Planeswalkers are basically absent from the format, and everything else is just, like, mostly a big mopey creature for the most part, which you can kill through other means.
Yeah, I mean, you can play with 4 Field of Ruin, 4 Demolition Field, 4 Assassin's Trophy, and then lose because your cards don't do anything, but yeah.
So let's talk about the, I guess we can very quickly touch on Long Goodbye. So this is the uncountable eliminate. So 1 on a black, can't be countered, destroy target creature or planeswalker with mana value 3 or less. Eliminate was good, this card is good, obviously has its limits, but those are written on the card, so you can't say you were deceived about those. I think the main thing in Standard is there's always been this question around the cheap removal of how does this line up against specifically Rafine, and this card lines up real nice against Rafine and also against any mix of, like, Shuna, Inti, Gix, like Sentinel and Glissa out of Golgari, all of the threats which threaten to run away with the game early if uncontested. You can kill a bat with this, that's always nice. So I think it's easy and tempting to just have a bunch of these. Obviously falls off once you get to, like, this can't kill a Shieldred, and that's a big problem sometimes, or anything larger than that. But as an addition to the removal roster in Standard, this is a really nice pickup there.
Yeah, my skepticism on this card is that I have never seen an Anoint with Affliction in a main deck, but like, this is probably better than most of the Anoints that end up in sideboards.
Yeah, and I think you not seeing those in main decks might just be a little bit of deck building inertia, if anything. Like, I'm not saying you should always have a ton, but there have been points where you want some cutdowns, but you also want some annoyance, and Go for the Throat has been surprisingly good in Standard, but like, at some point, there are enough things it won't hit that doesn't become an easy default anymore. So I think that this card immediately will have some kind of impact, and you're going to see these quite varied splits of like 2 to 3 Go for the Throat, 2 to 3 copies of this, however many cutdowns you think are still necessary just because that card costs one, and when it costs one, costing one matters, it really matters a lot. But that is a good problem to have, I think, and a fun one to watch people engage with. Let's get into, I think, the elephant in the room here, certainly for Pioneer with the Pro Tour coming up, and that is No More Lies. So this is the Azorius Mana Leak, if you like, white and a blue instant, kind of target spell unless its controller pays 3, and then you exile that spell instead of putting it into its owner's graveyard. So Mana Leak, just actual factual Mana Leak, would have been a big deal for Pioneer. This one is obviously more specific, like you can't talk yourself into playing this in some mostly worse blue-black control deck or something, or as some sideboard card in your Phoenix deck. This is just a tool for blue-white control, but this is a really, really good tool for blue-white control, I think, which could... I mean, that deck was had already gone from, like, overrated and overplayed to actually just legitimately one of the best decks, and I think this vaults it up into, if not a tier of its own, at least gains it a default spot as a top deck or the top deck, which if your deck is bad against this, it better be really damn good against everything else.
How do you think this card changes your mana base? That was the thing, like, it wasn't whether or not it would see play in the deck, it's just, does this card, especially in the Yorion decks, where because of the, like, it's mild, but because of the nature of 80 card decks where, like, you can kind of perform this thought experiment with an infinite card deck where if you draw an island from your infinite card deck, it doesn't reduce the odds that your next card is an island. So therefore, the bigger your deck is, the more likely your hands are going to be like all lands that produce single blue. How much do you think this changes the lands that you're allowed to play because of like little considerations like that? Like, you have to be a little more split on your like basics and your Odawaras. Like, does anything get trimmed along those lines? But yeah, it's just going to go in the deck. That's the puzzle to me, is like the side quest of how do I fix my mana, because unlike Dovin's Veto, this card needs to get cast on turn 2.
Yeah, I think you mostly just get to have your cake and eat it there. Like, so many of the utility lands in blue-white make one of those colors anyway. So both castles, both channel lands, Hall of Storm Giants, really most of the other options in between there too. The one exception is the Field of Ruin effects, which only do that on a kind of time delay. And so, yeah, if you need to cast this on turn 2 and you don't have the option to play a land other than Field of Ruin, then that can really mess you up. Unclear to me how many of those effects you necessarily wanted in the first place. And already the deck had main deck Dovin's Veto, which I expect it still will in some number, especially if this card being printed vaults blue-white up in the format even further. So your mana base already had to nod towards that to some degree. And with a temporary lockdown and the Yorion list, like you had this incentive to get double white early and to like have this good mix of your colors. So I don't think it changes all that much about how you have to build it, as long as you are mindful of it. And it is a very worthwhile incentive to not really have to do anything different for.
Yeah, and it does actually almost promote, like, there have been Sunken Citadel lists popping up lately that are using it to fuel the Field of Runes, but, like, Citadel is the perfect answer to the how do you cast your blue-white spell on turn 2. It's like, well, this is my dual land that also lets me rapidly filter my Field of Runes out of colorless mana, so that just all makes sense to me. So maybe the answer is just no changes. Cut the 7th or 8th Field of Rune and call it a day.
Right, and I think the issue with the blue-white decks and Pioneer historically has been that kind of universal cheap stack interaction where everything else the deck has some of the best versions of those effects that we've ever seen. So, you know, Memmi Deluge as your, like, fact or fiction style card. Teferi, of course, as the thing which puts you ahead in the game, but also, like, locks up the game as a finisher. You've got a ton of good dual lands, utility lands, all of that good stuff. You've got some good sweepers, especially now that Temporary Lockdown is so good at what it does. You kind of have it all, except for just a good, like, 2-mana counter-target spell with these conditions style card. And Mage Disappear kind of is that, but this is really not a good Mage Disappear deck. This is a very, very good Mana Leak deck, though. So, yeah, I think this does fill a hole that needed to be filled. And I don't think the recursion is going to matter a ton, although when it does, it is often game-changing. So against Black-Red, for example, you tag a hard-cast Croaksa with this early, you know that's not going to be a threat a few turns down the line. Or, you know, in the super long games where they get to escape the same Croaksa multiple times, if you counter it with one, then that is not a problem you have to deal with anymore. Likewise, against Phoenix, a lot of the games will come down to them just casting Phoenix and then forcing you to interact with it and then having this follow-up wave, and this just hits the Phoenix on the stack. Or if they're going for some like Galvanic Iteration into Cruise or Trespass line, then in some cases, this is worse than Mage Disappear against those, but just getting to counter the Galv or interfere with the Galv straight up is really nice. So, yeah, I think this Mana Leak would have been great just by itself. This is a really nice Mana Leak to get access to, and yeah, I think Blue-White Control, I'm settling in for some very long rounds at the PT, where there's going to be a lot of control mirrors, a lot of control decks, and knowing how your deck lines up against control is going to be, like, the most important question, I think. And that's one thing that I found in my early testing so far, like, not giving anything away, but I don't really have anything to give away, is that there are a lot of decks, frankly, which kind of like their matchups across the board, but are pretty shaky against blue-white. So Amalia being, like, a very obvious one, but that really goes for a lot of the decks which try to target Rakdos and stuff in the past. I think it's kind of difficult now to escape the squeeze of Rakdos on the one hand and blue-white on the other, these two fair decks, which are both very good at being their style of fair deck, but which attack you in quite different ways. And so it's hard for any, like, conventional strategy to line up well against both at the same time. Or for most of the unconventional strategies too, honestly.
Yeah, I had been fiddling around with, like, a lot of random stuff in the format, and it is very demoralizing and hard to do that when you just play 1 to 2.5 Azorius decks every single league, and you're like, yeah, cool, we're just not constructed to defeat these set of cards, on to the next match. I think,
yeah,
the,
or you know, my beloved Enchantes, yeah, which I would love any excuse to register that at the PT. And it's like, well, yeah, if I do, I'm going to line my odds against Black Red. I can probably find a build where I like my odds against stuff like Phoenix and Amalia and stuff, but trying to even be tenable at all against Blue Eye just feels utterly hopeless for the most part. So it's, I think there are a lot of decks in that space where the existence of Blue-White really, as a top deck, really helps you squeeze those out. And in that regard, I think you're seeing Pioneer kind of move in the same direction as Modern, almost, where you have this top tier of quite a few different, like, fair-ish decks, and those combine or collude to kind of force a lot of other stuff out of the format. And so if you compare the complaints about current Pioneer to the complaints about Pioneer as of like 6 or 12 months ago, where the format was actually super open, there was a lot of stuff you could do, but it felt like the in-game decisions often didn't matter too much, or the games were pretty swingy. I thought that was always a little bit overstated, but that was the kind of a consensus view of Pioneer, was that, yeah, it's diverse, but at what cost? Now I think the format is going to look increasingly less diverse, even if a lot of the games will be more contested and more interactive, just because, like, all of Phoenix, which is another part of this puzzle too, and Black Red and Blue White are all top decks. And then I think a lot of the decks that are best at finding those are going to be other fair decks that are built to exploit those in some way. So you're going to see a lot of really grindy, really fair magic, which, depending on your philosophy, that may be exactly what you want or exactly what you want to avoid. But I think that is, for now, what you have in store looking at the PT here.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I want to speak to the, like, sort of unspoken piece about, like, why is a Mana Leak so much better than a Make Disappear? Imagine it like you are trying to double spell with a 2-drop and a 2-drop versus a 2-drop and a 3-drop. And, like, it's just, like, one of these is just good, clean, normal curve-out magic. And the other is, like, standard mid-range clunk fest. And that's just the experience of playing against a Mana Leak instead of a Make Disappear. Just every single turn. It just hits so many things for so much longer. It's really just not the same card.
Yeah, and in terms of standard, so those same base Azorius tempo decks, which really could make good use of Mate Disappear before, there is kind of more of a question whether you change to this. It's not like a strict upgrade, but I think most of the time it will be. But either way, it's in the matchups where you want just more counter magic, then this doubles down on that. And I think for those decks in general, really nice tool to have. And then we did see at Worlds, not successfully, but there were some like hardcore control decks. Greg Orange did break through into top 8 with his ban list, but then some Esper lists as well. And a card like this may be enough to give those decks a shot in the arm too. And in those contexts, it is a lot better than Mage Disappear is.
Yeah, I think the thing that interests me there is just like, it is a reason to shift which colors are in your deck in a format that has become relatively color stagnant.
Yeah, and so I don't know if this is almost the thing that gets Lightning Helix back in the door, because you start exploring more blue-white XX, and then you decide the thing that deck is missing is a Mana Leak of some kind, or a Lightning Helix of some kind, and lo and behold, there's a Lightning Helix, a literal one, just there, ready to go. But that's the kind of exploration that you get to do again now. So going to be excited to see how Standard shakes out ahead of the GP-style event in Chicago, which I definitely plan on releasing some content for. I think maybe you do as well. And that's going to be a weirdly unexplored format, because it's not like the kind of a SEG open into PT kind of a lead that we had before for the standard PTs, but also there's no big prior standard events before that for anyone to use as this bellwether. So it is going to be, you know, what does Mogged win the standard challenge with on Magic Online if he's not too busy with PT testing? And then what do people extrapolate from that? But I think it's the kind of format which if that is your sole focus for the next few weeks, there potentially is a very big edge to be gained.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm sitting. It's the side events at that event are really weird because they're so split by format, but it doesn't seem like they're for different people. Like, the standard 75k players are probably going to try to play the PTQ the next day, or like play the Secret Lair Showdowns if that goes wrong, and those are just three different formats. I'm going to focus on standard, and this card is going to be a big piece of like what is going to change from the existing state of the format, but the other two I might just have to punt on, like, I don't know, open a sealed deck and see what happens and play a generic modern deck, which we'll get to later.
Mm-hmm. And then we have a whole cycle of cards, which is getting people chattering, certainly in modern, but across the board as well. And these are the typed Surveil Duels. So if you were a fan of Temples back in the day, then these are for you. So the basic formula here is, for example, the black-red one, it's a swamp and it's a mountain. When ETBs, you surveil one, and it ETBs tapped. So these are mostly a strict upgrade to Temples, even when the typing doesn't matter. There's always some edge cases where, like, if you're a combo deck, which recently in these bigger formats, those are the decks that have gravitated more towards Temples, more so than fair decks. Sometimes there is a downside to, you know, your ad nauseum deck in modern that ran like 8 temples back in the day, like milling over your one lightning storm or something at the wrong time, or being forced to like keep it there so that you didn't do that. That was actually a meaningful cost. Whereas I think for the most part, like, there are more just incidental graveyard synergies going around than anything else, that for almost every deck, Surveil is a straight upgrade, but you could imagine this coming up. I've seen some talk about these as like, in modern Yawgmoth, for example, where there's some amount of like graveyard stuff going on, but also if you have some one-off in your deck that you might need to Call of Calling for in 3 turns, then having to mill that away is potentially disastrous. How often does that happen when it's a one-off in a 50-something card deck? Probably not all that often, and maybe if it does, you can figure it out anyway. But that's the kind of thing which gets focused on because it is so marginal, but it's like the only interesting thing left to talk about, because outside of that, these cards just are straight up very good, I think.
Yeah, and I think that it's almost comparable to like how there is a Dryad Arbor in a lot of random modern creature decks, like or I guess creature combo decks specifically, that can fetch a forest like Yawgmoth, where it's just like, this is a little bit of chip shot value that you can fetch up. These are the like better to draw, but also like less powerful but more broad application version of that. So like, yeah, there's probably just going to be one of them in a lot of spots.
Yeah, in a standard context, I'm keen to see where these land, because the three color decks, to some extent, you might think need to lean on Triumphs instead, although even most of the stock Esper list, for example, have consciously found ways to cut Rafine's Tower or minimize that from their deck, because a land that is essentially just a tap fixing land is not what they want, and they have so many other good, mostly untapped or always untapped fixing options that they just don't need to resort to that sort of thing. And in the all of those color combinations, you do now have a very good cycle of man lands as well. So in Esper, you know, do any of these Surveil lands make the cut over Restless Anchorage or Restless Reef? And then even if you're in Strait d'Amir, you might decide either A, I don't want any tapped land at all if I can avoid it, or if I do, I want those to be Restless Reef, which is a really, really good man land, and not this kind of Surveil land with a mostly incidental benefit. So I don't think we're back in the OG Temple days where just by default, even the aggro decks kind of felt priced into running the temples and their color combinations, and certainly the mid-range decks just loaded up on temples. Even there, though, looking back, there was this interesting debate that emerged over time where, like, the stock Abzan list, for example, you would start those out with four Sunset Citadel and then, you know, six to eight temples of some mix of colors in there. And over time, you saw people question if you actually wanted that many tap lands in the first place, or for the number of tap lands that you did have, did you even need the full four Sandstep Citadels once your mana, with all these other fixing options like Pain Lands and the Allied Fetches, got to the point where that was all that land was doing for you and you didn't even need it in the first place? So I could see us almost working our way back into that territory again, where you might see these seemingly very wonky numbers of all of these different lands, of all of these different cycles in a deck at the same time.
Yeah, my biggest problem for these in standard is that I mean, you pointed this out, but like, it's not even just Anchorage and Reef. It's every other Restless land. I cannot imagine playing a Surveil Temple over I don't even know which ones I play a Surveil Temple over any of. Like, maybe, I don't know, the green-white one, but I'm more likely just to not play tapped lands in my deck. Like, it has to be a spot where it's like, I am playing my Restless land, but it gets bad in multiples, and therefore, like, you want exactly two to three, and then you fill in with the Surveil land because it provides value in a different time frame. But, like, I don't know which one is that. Can you name one of the Restless lands that is that, as opposed to just good and you want all of them?
Like, I guess some kind of quite mid-rangey black-white deck, maybe, just because the black-white manland is so uninspiring in relative terms. But even there, most of those decks have a bunch of, like, wedding announcements, Virtue of Loyalties, Wandering Emperors, and so just having a creature that can just be activated on demand, like, has a very high upside. And then there are some manlands which haven't really shown up, like the blue-red one isn't that great, the red-green one, but I think that is more just a case of there being few decks that want any kind of tap land in those specific color combinations than because those lands themselves are unplayable, and for those decks, they don't want a Surveil land either. So yeah, I think that it's going to be much harder for these lands to find that kind of audience in standard, and so you might see what we saw the second time the temples came in Theros Beyond Death, where they kind of landed with a whimper and didn't really make much of an impact, and you actually had the same overlap there with Ikoria bringing the other Cycle of Triomes in the very next set. And so if you look at stuff like the Team of Reclamation decks of the era, like, these are three color decks with ostensibly pretty demanding mana requirements, but with Triomes and, you know, again, like a whole bevy of other options, like, you didn't just default to, I'll start my deck with a bunch of temples and build out from there. You actually had to justify those cards' existence there for the first time.
Yeah, and I'm also just running the thought experiment of, would I play any of these in Domain to shore up the mana beyond just playing a billion Triomes? And I think the answer is I would just add more Triomes to my deck.
Yeah, so that one I think is kind of interesting, because in Domain, the way that a lot of lists are built, you have at least one color and sometimes two, which are effectively very minimal in the deck outside of I need to technically have the fourth or fifth color of Domain. And so if you get to the point where you are basically playing like Bant with a light dash of black and red, then maybe you do want to work in some temples instead of those other fixing options. That said, if you want that full discount on your leyline binding, if you want to have full domain by the time you get up there, then you have to reconfigure other triomes to get there, or you'll end up having to herd migration for like the off-color mountain or swamp more than you used to. So that isn't free either. And yeah, so the triomes add this other squeeze of like the two-color decks often will not want or need fixing like this, and then the decks which are like four plus colors are going to lean quite heavily on triumphs instead. And so you're relying on the decks in the middle to pick up the slack, but as we said, even they are moving away from this kind of fixing in the first place. So I'm actually less optimistic about these four standard, even though the barrier to entry there should be a lot lower. And then Pioneer is kind of the same deal, right, where like there's even more options there. We've moved to a spot now where even the ally colors actually do have good fixing compared to a few years ago, where that was almost the thing that stood out about Pioneer, was how bad the ally fixing was in comparison to the enemy colors. But now just across the board, it's all great. So actually, we come back, as we always do in the end, to fetch lands in Modern. And this is, if collect evidence was on the up the beanstalk half of the like offensive design patterns, this is firmly in the fetch land side, where it's like, I don't think fetch lands needed to be better, and it's kind of sad that it takes just the ubiquity of fetch lands for these cards to even find an audience there in the first place, but given that they do, we should talk about them in that context.
Yeah, I do want to briefly pour one out for how good the blue-green one of these would be in Breach Lotus back in the day, but gladly that is gone, and we don't have to worry about anything going on there, and we can talk about things that actually are allowed to still occur.
I mean, Lotus is still a deck, notionally, and was actually a deck that had literal Temple of Mystery in it. So we will see how that materializes. And I could even see if we get to wanting to support the triple green charm in some capacity, and more on that later, then maybe just more temples is the way you bridge that gap. But for now, here in Modern, I think that there is some of the same issue on each side, where if you are some like four color deck, for example, whether it's just a normal four color or creativity or whatever, then you have your triumphs first and you expect to be fetching those. Any kind of leyline binding deck, of course, like you really value having the extra type in there. And then once you have your triumphs, finding room for like a third or a fourth fetchable tap land is not easy unless you have more than 60 cards. So if this were still the Yorion days, maybe this would be a different conversation. But for now, there's a limit to how much you can do that, especially in a deck like Creativity, I think, where your mana base is already hopelessly fragile, and you have these Dwarven Mines and stuff which threaten to mess you up, and I don't know, I think it's, you kind of need that effect there more, but it's even harder to justify it. And just those decks across the board, I think, they have like a vague interest in these cards, but everything else has to come first. And then on the other end of things, you have a lot of these decks which their main selling point is how low their curve is and how well they use all of their mana most of the time. So like, you could theoretically put a blue red one of these in Murktide, for example, but then the cost of drawing like an actual tap land is so damaging so much of the time that I think this almost has to be an extra land and not one that counts towards your natural land count. And at that point, it's even harder to talk yourself into it. Like, how many complaints have you seen about just Spire Bluff Canal entering play tap like on turn four, on turn five, some amount of the time, right? And this always has the downside of Spire Bluff Canal and not much of the upside either.
Yeah, I do want to make one counterpoint. There's a second Steam Vents in the stock creativity list that just instantly becomes one of these, I think.
Yeah, that's fair. Although maybe my takeaway there is I kind of just want another land in creativity to begin with. Not that I want to play creativity, but you know, if I lived in that universe. I think other decks, there are some decks like on the border where it gets kind of interesting, I think. So like Yawgmoth, for example, where you already have a fetchable Dryad Arbor. You already, in some lists, have other random tap lands, just like a colony garden here and there. And in that deck, which also can have some colored mana issues, the idea of a like good fetchable surveil land in both of your colors in a combo deck which needs to find specific cards, like that, all of that adding up may be enough to get that one across the line. And then I mean Amulet has the issue of there are already so many more good lands than you can play, and so even though like, yeah, you played Temple of Mystery 7 years ago, a lot of good lands have been printed since then. That said, I mean, if you end up playing a fetch hand again, you already have generous sense in the sideboard, you're getting besaged a lot these days. Like, the idea of just having a land like that in the right colors that you can fetch reasonably often and find, like, it's not the craziest thing in the world to me, but I still don't expect it to make it there. I think the place where I do actively expect these to show up is in Cascade decks, or specifically Rhinos, where, I mean, this is a deck which has to take the first two turns off for the most part, really needs to hit its third land drop every game, and have the right things to do once it gets there. And that deck has a Keptria Triome, which I've seen people try to cut from the deck because just having a tap land there is so rough, which is also a criticism against these lands, but the Surveil upside may be enough to get that one in there in place of the Triome, if not alongside it.
Yeah, and I actually weirdly am interested in this card in Living End, but in the reverse context, like, I don't want to mill a creature. I want to fetch a land that makes it more likely for me to find my next land. It's probably not good enough, but I do want to throw that exact thing out there.
It is funny that if you go back to the decks in Modern, like the much maligned Ad Nauseam, which did used to run a bunch of temples, I'm never sure how credit even was in those decks to begin with, but now that setup is basically strictly inferior to just having even more fetches and, let's say, two temples or two Surveil lands that you can fetch with these. So it's kind of sad to see those quite distinct mana bases just flattened out into yet another, like, fetch lands plus type land mana base, but doing that does mean that other decks which would never have considered a temple under any other circumstances, now actually they get to have that debate too, and you might open up this new kind of a frontier in gameplay for them too. So it's not a, you are getting something in return, but it is sad to see that kind of a homogeneity spread even further.
My counter argument is that I have not seen a single Ad Nauseam or Storm deck attempting to do that in so many years that it was dead already.
Well, as research for this talking point, I went to see what Masmanovsky's latest list looked like these days. So this is one of the Modo Grinders who used to just religiously play Ad Nauseam, and then I can't believe it's not Ad Nauseam. You know, the namesake card had gone, but the rest of the shell remained. And it turns out that not only does his latest list not have any temples at all, and hasn't had for quite a while, but he's no longer even playing Ad Nauseam. He has become a Domain Zoo main instead somehow.
You know what? I'm happy. I'm happy that people can move past and change and become better.
Yes. Well, let's move on to some of the new, like, combo cards, build around cards from the set here. And there's a lot of them. So I think most of these are not going to really deliver on any initial hype. And so we want to treat these as, like, quick hits, which if we have more to say, we can. But there's a lot of these, so we want to kind of rocket through them. So the first one that stood out to me was Relive the Past. This is the 5 green-white, like, mass reanimation effect. You get an artifact, a land, and an enchantment back from your graveyard. They become 5/5 elementals. And I don't have, like, a package in mind for this, but this struck me as the kind of, like, Eerie Ultimatum, Command the Dreadhorde style, like, big flashy endgame, which you can kind of build the rest of your deck around getting towards. Unclear if at that point this is better than, like, just hard casting stuff like Atraxa, or finding other ways to treat Atraxa in, or that. If this is not even the best effect at its own, like, power level or mana cost, then that might just be a death knell automatically. But at least a neat card to note for your notebooks there.
Yeah, I was trying to think of how you get the varying card types in your graveyard to begin with. Land is easier than I sort of initially expected, because I forgot you can just slap an extra Igonjo in your deck, but the others are a little dicey.
Yeah, and there's stuff like Invoke Justice in Standard, for now at least, which is kind of in the same space, but kind of cheaper and blunter. I think the issue is, like, so many of the best things to get back right now are creatures of some kind. There's always, like, Portal to Phyrexia or stuff like that, but for the most part, you kind of have to build around this and go out of your way to put less desirable reanimation targets in just to be able to get them back again, and then find a way to get them in the graveyard. And after all that, you know, you're still having to resolve a 7 mana spell, which is never trivial in the first place. So a potentially exciting card, but not one that I expect to come through the way that some of those, like big flashy finishers have done in the past. One that I do have slightly higher hopes for in a very specific context is World Souls Rage. So this is X red green. World Souls Rage deals X damage to any target, and you put up to X land cards from your hand and or graveyard onto the battlefield tap. So right now, the Amulet players out there are coping and seething and looking for increasingly deranged ways to handle Magus of the Moon. And this is a card which, it does do that, but it does also do so much more as well, and like is a mostly on plan functional card in your combo style Ram deck, as opposed to like the Bone Crusher Giants or whatever that you see showing up in a lot of sideboards.
I think you're stretching some definitions here of like how I think that the fact that this costs green mana is kind of disqualifying in that category for me.
Yeah, I mean, you need to get there first. Like, that goalpost is relatively easy to meet. It's actually successfully unlocking everything else once you get there, which an expensive sorcery is also not great at doing, especially if your scam opponent's protecting their Magus with a Not Dead After All, or your Motad opponent just has blue mana up. Like, you're never going to feel too safe about that. But as a card which, when they don't have Magus, just in the normal games, can actually get you to your natural goal, I will test it at least. I may pre-order some cheap foil copies for the Amulet box and then never actually dust them off on paper again, but I will hold out hope for something better. My beloved Aftermath analyst, we should touch on quickly here. So this is, as we mentioned, Splendid Reclamation attached to a 1 energy 1/3 that mills you for 3 when it ETBs. I don't have a clear way to make the most of that effect outside of Modern yet, where you can do the whole like Dryad plus Valakut stuff. You can find ways to turn that into relevant stuff. I think in Pioneer, that the cadence of that format is a lot more suited to this kind of endgame. But like, what are we doing with that? Because now that we don't have stuff like Field of the Dead, you don't have a payoff there that's attached to a land. There's a lot of lands which sacrifice themselves or cycle themselves, or there's man lands and there's deserts and there's all of this other stuff. But if you're just flopping a bunch of lands into play, then you need to get to the next step somehow. And figuring out something once you have that many lands should not be all that difficult. But it's another condition to making this deck work, which I have not tried to meet yet.
Yeah, I don't really understand what the accomplishment of the shell you're describing is relative to the like Bring to Light Scapeshift setup that started existing with Spelunking. It feels like about the same amount of work, but you're putting more cards that you don't necessarily want to draw into your deck.
Yeah, I mean, there might be some kind of Spelunking deck where this is part of what you're doing there. Like, it doesn't actually replace Splendid Reclamation in the list that are trying to bring to light for that. But there might just be some separate, like, Aftermath Analyst Spelunking 4 Lotus Field deck where just Lotus Field is a great card to draw, and then pairing it with these combo pieces like really vaults it into the stratosphere.
This really sounds like you're making alternate Azorius Lotus Field and are just lining up the tweet about how difficult it is to sequence your land reanimation draw. I don't know where this is going, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, speaking of which, let's touch on Archdruid's Charm quickly. So this is the... I don't know if there's some emerging mega cycle here with Archmage's Charm, and then... what was the AFR demon thing? Archduke, Zariel, whatever. Like, that was an Arc something. That could be the triple red charm. So we'll find something to fill this out eventually. But for now, what we have is triple green, and then the three modes are Exile, Target, Artifact, or Enchantment. So a nice starting point there. You can put a +1/+1 counter on a creature you control, and it fights something you don't control, and then, or it just deals damage, excuse me, it bites. And then the final mode, and I think the most interesting one, is search your library for a creature or land card and reveal it. If it's a land, you put it onto the battlefield tapped, otherwise you put it into your hand and then shuffle. So any kind of, like we spoke about Analyzer Pollen in a similar context, where you not only have to jump through the hoops that it asks you for, but it's also, what are you even finding that is worth that work in the first place? In the case of Arcturus Charm, there are some more obvious answers, and most of those are lands, honestly. So Nykthos and Lotus Field would be the two big ones here. There already is, you know, a dormant but ready to be revived mono-green devotion deck that just this fits into the mana base naturally, and then this gets you one of your most important cards or can find you a payoff for having all of that mana. And then in Lotus Field, you would have to rejig the mana base quite substantially to just cast this on three often enough. But when you do, this fixes one of the key issues the deck had of just not finding Lotus Field in a relevant time frame. And then once you do have that, this can find you the Baseju or Odawara if you need interaction. It can find you the stage, should be the second Lotus Field. Or as a creature, you can find like Leah just manually to start going off from there. Or this can find Vizier, this can find like, I don't know, Zakama, Emrakul, Dramoka, like whatever giant idiot you have in your sideboard there. So the card is very flexible, but does require a bit of setup just in terms of paying the cost, if nothing else.
I do want to add a caveat. You are required to put it onto the battlefield if it's a land, so I don't know how you're getting that Poseidon from the battlefield.
Okay.
For some reason, this is the thing that they've decided to maintain as non-optional. That's a different discussion, but I like it in those contexts as like the next copies of Sylvan Scrying. I don't know exactly how many you want, but it feels like at least one, probably about one. I don't know if the exact number is one or two, but it's more than zero of the like impulse shimmer of possibility slot is probably better off as this effect. There also might be a reason to want an instant speed Lotus Field as opposed to a sorcery speed one. This might be time to just bust out talking about a card that we sort of glossed over, but was previously on my list of things I dislike the most, and that's not quite a build around, but it's Krenko's Buzzcrusher. This is the two red, 4/4 flying artifact creature that ETB Field of Runes, but not like that. You want to, I don't even want to talk about the words. It doesn't target. I don't know why this is like absurd that like, I don't know, the P. Sully rant where he's just like, talks about how the natural state of this is like, you suddenly have an ability that's like, this card is untargetable, but this one's unchoosable. And then like everything is just like, you've lost the plot at some point. Like, this is the start of it and it needs to end. But also, I don't really think that card is good enough. I don't really think it's just like, even against Lotus, it feels like they should be able to just beat that card heads up if they know it exists.
Yeah, so I was confused about why other people were confused about this card. Like, I saw a lot of questions on Twitter about why it was worded that way. And I even saw some people tagging, like, Mark Rosewater and other designers asking for official clarification about whether it was meant to work this way or whether it was just a typo of some kind. And it's like, I feel like if you have ever seen the card Lotus Field before, then you know why this card is worded the way it is. Like, it's not, it doesn't seem at all tough to put two and two together there. And it has to be worded in this very roundabout, awkward way in order to do that. But to me, that's a much bigger indictment of the card Lotus Field and there's the choice to make that card and the necessary issues with it than of Krenko's Buzzcrusher, which is, he's just a little guy kind of doing his thing. And I agree that this card by itself does not obsolete Lotus Field. I don't think it's that strong against it necessarily, especially, maybe if you have more access to instant speed Lotus Field effects now. I do think that it's an interesting option for decks like, for example, the Gruul, formerly Gruul Vehicles, now just Gruul stuff with like Huntsman's Redemption, where this is actually a tutorable hate card for Lotus Field, which those colors really lacked in the past. Or I can imagine some list of like Enigmatic, for example, where you have some 3-drop enchantment and then you can Enigmatic that away into this, and that actually buys you enough time to like get further lock pieces on future turns and snap that shut. So I think it's an intriguing option, but not really a game-changing one. But in terms of why is this card the way that it is, I feel like it's overwhelmingly obvious why this card is the way that it is, and the complaints directed towards it should just be directed at Lotus Field instead.
Also, whoever was like, this feels like, the homework that you like wrote the night before and turned in. It's like, please design a thing that answers a Lotus Field. And like, here we go. I'm going to get full credit for this, but realistically, I'm glad that the scale is a one or a zero. I think it's a lazy design. And I think that, we should do better and design cards that don't make players. Like, I think it is very reasonable, on the other hand, to like, I don't want to have to think about the context of this other card to ask whether this is a typo on a common templating. Because, like, I don't know. I'm very much in the camp of I don't know why this exists the way it does. if you could just make something that's better.
Do you have a cleaner template in mind?
I think that my initial is if someone came to me with this card and asked me what to do, is I would ask them to test it as probably barter in like a, you know, each player sacrifices two non-basics and like Field of Runes them for lands with basic types and test that out. I think that might have some weird externalities though, but like at that point I would really just sit down and ask why we are printing this card instead of just banning Lotus Field if we care that much.
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been other seemingly much less offensive cards in the past that have used the similar choose something for each player template instead of targeting, mostly in the context of like something like Council Judgment is pretty unwieldy in two player, but stuff like that, or even Sundering Titan, right, where it's the way it plays out in practice is there's you don't know which lands are being destroyed before the thing resolves, and so that can lead to some weird like timing issues or whatever, but no one has the same complaints there. With this one, it is just because this card is so overtly designed to be able to kill Lotus Field, and because that is the only reason that anyone would be interested in it in the first place. So again, I think all routes lead back to Lotus Field there, and I think just as much as I have enjoyed playing Lotus Field decks and trying to build them, and just the fact that the card exists, it's this like font of creativity. At the same time, like when you put Hexproof on a land like that, like if a land is easy enough to interact with, it becomes effectively unplayable with that steep of a cost. And then if you can't interact with it, then a Hexproof land, like you're looking at basically just stuff like Damping Sphere in the Pioneer card pool, and that doesn't leave people feeling much of a sense of agency either. So I think just Lotus Field being a good card in the format has put the designers and the players in this impossible position, honestly, which as sympathetic as I am to the deck in a lot of ways, I could see the argument for just eating it out of there entirely. And I'm honestly stunned that when they did like the combo deep clean in the summer of 2020, knocking out Inverter and Ballista, which you could have knocked out Heliod instead, but Ballista had to go, killing all of my Hardened Scales decks in the process, and Kethis even, which at this point, I think if Kethis was legal, it would be busted, but at the time it was firmly unplayable. They really overcorrected in all these different ways, and yet when it came to Lotus, they banned Underworld Breach, which was this great enabler slash finisher, but not the card, not the namesake card causing the issue here, and Lotus has just been either a good deck or the best deck at basically every point since then, so that feels like a miss. And instead of trying to double down on that and like finish the job, instead they printed these like beginner event decks that were just like powered down Lotus Field. They seem to be at least accepting the consequences of those actions, but now one of those consequences is we get these messy designs like this instead.
Yeah, I take issue with the fact that this is the way that it's handled. But the card itself as it exists is fine. I also do want to point out that there is a difference between this and Council's Judgment, where you like, I don't really understand what happens with Council's Judgments when you start having players assign targets of a spell as it resolves, and I don't want to find out.
Well, just never play any kind of a casual or competitive EDH, and I think you'll be safe on that front in the near future. Let's move on to two of the interesting options for Trinketeers who want to be comboing off with this set. So, Forensic Gadgeteer, this is 2 and a blue. Whenever you cast an artifact spell, you investigate, and then the activated abilities of artifacts you control cost 1 less, and this can only make them cost... They always have to cost at least 1 mana, basically, so you don't get to free roll any of those. So no endlessly cycling through Chromatic Stars for free or something. This does not go infinite with Thopter Sword, although the next card that we're going to talk about most certainly does. But this one is just a fairly intriguing build around of sorts, but I think at 3 mana, a lot of the artifact kind of setup cards or payoff cards are kind of clustered at that mana cost, and I'm not sure what the return is on this one, really. Like in Modern, where you have a bunch of Moxes and Mishra's Baubles and so on, you can generate a bunch of stuff, but then is that better than any of the other ways you have to do that? And also, what is the payoff that we're getting for that? Like, it just doesn't seem high enough to me. And then as you go down into smaller formats, I think there's just it's just not really worth a squeeze in the end. As cool as the card looks, I think it is more tame than it is dangerous.
Okay, there. I've got one for you. This is a blue card that goes infinite with Basalt Monolith in Legacy in ways that actually chains off. I put this card down where I wasn't entirely sure what it went off with, and then just like staring at it for a while, that is what happens. And I think that it is interesting in that context to the extent that like it probably is interesting in at least one more context I'm not thinking about.
Yeah, so you almost certainly could build some kind of blue artifact zombie deck in Legacy that just has Monolith and this, and then if you can stitch those together, that's really nice. Not sure how you fill out the rest of it, although that is a format where there are a ton of both free artifacts and artifacts with good activated abilities that you'd like to discount. So if it's going to succeed anywhere, it is going to be there for the most part. And then in the same space, we have Crime Novelist. So this is 2 and a red for a 1/3 goblin. Whenever you sack an artifact, you put a +1/+1 counter on it, and you add red to your mana pool. So this does go infinite with Thopter Sword, and also does make it kind of free to cycle your Chromatic Stars, Chromatic Spheres, stuff like that. You actually net mana if it's stuff like Conjurer's Bauble or other free sacrifice stuff. And then when you get to the like standard and pioneer morass of like blood tokens and food tokens and clue tokens, like it just makes it a lot easier to crack all of those at the same time. So this needs to be paired with the right stuff, but it fills a very unique role in a deck like that, which maybe, you know, opens up new possibilities now. So in Modern, maybe there's some deck which has Goblin Engineer and this and a heavy Thopter Sword component, but then also has Spell Bombs, Mistress Baubles, Chromatic Stars, and so this card by itself with enough of that just like stuff can translate into some big turn just manually and non-deterministically instead.
Yeah, I had not considered the direct interaction where this turns Mistress Bauble into Spirit God. Yes. That is probably the most interesting thing of this card.
Again, not that Mistress Bauble ever really needed that help or much help, but here we are. Turns out that just a free card that does a bunch of different things and takes a bunch of different boxes like is always going to be at least very solid there. So excited to see, again, like the aspiring spike brews to come out of this, and then also if anyone it puts more kind of dedicated work into it for something like, I don't even know when the next big Cyclone Modern tournaments is, but if I lose to some deranged Crime Novelist combo deck in Ottawa, I will give them a pat on the back and feel like I deserve my beatings there.
Yeah, and I think Crime Novelist, to me, one of the things that might set it apart from something like Goblin Electromancer is just like looking at it, how easy it is for it to go off on the spot, whereas I think with like Electromancer and Baral, you are weirdly more tethered in the sense of like, it's easy to just, like, set yourself up with, like, Sphere, Star, Bauble, play this, generate a bunch of mana off all these sacrifices. Your opponent is also, like, even if they respond with a kill spell, you have generated your mana and can go off with other stuff in response. Whereas with Baral, you just are like, I'm going to play Baral, and I'm going to cast Heretic Ritual, and then they just kill your thing, and then you've got 3 red mana floating and nothing else to do with your life.
Mm-hmm. And then one of the cards which could spawn a whole like namesake deck by itself is Reenact the Crime. So this is the 1 and triple blue instant. You exile target non-land card in a graveyard that was put there from anywhere this turn, is the crucial condition. You copy it and you can cast a copy without paying its mana cost. So instantly visions of discarding an Emrakul to Underworld Cookbook and then just casting that, or replace Emrakul with any big idiot of your choice there, and then whatever the format, there's going to be something worth doing that on if you can set it up. So I've seen people talk about like Enter the Infinite in Pioneer, for example, or getting some good output of this is not the issue. The issue is setting it up and actually having that be good, not just in game one, but also against the very popular and very effective Graveyard Hate that's in basically every sideboard at this point.
Yeah, but the thing about this is that because it's all instant speed, a lot of the Graveyard Hate in Pioneer is notably sorcery speed. Like a lot of the go blank Graveyard Trespasser style stuff is not impacting your graveyard on your turn between the time where your card goes to the graveyard and then on the same turn returns. So I think that there's at least a window with the way decks are currently constructed to, like, you know, how many people have their unlicensed hearses this week? Not as many as you think.
Yeah, I've also seen some talk about pairing this with the Torrential Gearhulk, like Strixhaven channel cards, like Magma Opus, Elemental Masterpiece, Creative Outburst, where those, you can still pair those with Gearhulk, of course, but then you can discard one and then use your treasure to cast the Reenact the Crime on that same one in one flurry, so you can still get a pretty big discount on your Magma Opus, and then also this is an instant which you can flashback with Torrential Gearhulk, so in a much longer game you can kind of upgrade that sequence to discard my Magma Opus, cast my Gearhulk, flashback the Reenact the Crime, which doesn't even exile itself when it resolves, and then get back the Magma Opus and go from there even. So there's, or I guess in that case you could just get back the Opus anyway, so scratch that, ignore that, but you could maybe there's some sequence where you Gearhulk a Reenact that gets back another Gearhulk, and then that one gets back the Magma Opus, so you can kind of layer these on top of each other, so you get more redundancy at a baseline, and then if you have more moving parts to fiddle around with, you can actually stick them together for a bigger effect.
Yeah, the thing I was sort of trying to envision was, I guess it's probably like a more contained version of some of the Rona combo decks, where you're also splicing in the Luka engine, where like Reenact plus Rona can put an Atrax into play, and then you also have Luka, but I like the Torrential Gearhulk idea a little better.
Yeah, kind of nice with Jace Rin's Prodigy in that regard too, because that can discard the thing that you want to get back, and then when Jace transforms, it can flashback the Reenact the Crime and then cast it on that thing. So you get to buy back every part of the engine in one go there. So a lot of cool stuff you can do with this. I don't think it's going to end up proving that dangerous in the end, but I mean, I don't want to be wrong about that, but it would kind of be exciting, at least in the short term.
I think it's costed so that if it's dangerous, it's going to be interesting and fair. Like, one blue-blue-blue is a relatively big constraint. As opposed to something costing, I don't know, fake quad green that is actually zero.
Well, what the hell is this card? So this is a Ley Knight of the Guild Pact. It is basically all of the green hybrid mana symbols. So green-white, green-blue, green-red, green-black, and once you see this, you can't unsee it, so I'm sorry to everyone who's about to have their day ruined here, but why the first two hybrid symbols have the green mana on top, and then the second ones have it on the bottom, I'm sure there's some antique color pie reason why that's the right protocol, but it just looks so unclean and so messy on the card. And then you get to the text box, which is the whole another issue. So, as usual with a ley line, if it's in your opening hand, you can start with it in play. Each non-land permanent you control is all colors, and lands you control are every basic land type in addition to their other types. So you get this Prismatic Omen plus Painter's Servant or plus kind of effect, which that part is whatever, I think. There's not too much that actually like counts colors in a relevant way where you would want to use this to set it up. But the Prismatic Omen thing, I think, is very relevant, and it could lead you to build some of the, frankly, strangest mana bases I've ever seen in a Magic deck before.
Yeah, so to answer your question about the mana symbols, there actually is a stated reason that they follow throughout all card templating, which is that going clockwise, the hybrid mana symbols are in the order that is the shortest jump. So green to white would be one clockwise, white to green would be four. So that throughout, which is why it flips. But yes, it does look stupid. I don't enjoy this card for the fact that it is quad green devotion. I do enjoy this card for the fact that it might actually make Sign of Draco a playable card. And the fact that, like, you're gonna, like, it's the Twitch chat thing. It's like, they're tapping their fetch lands for mana. It's like, no, there's an Urborg and a Leyline of the Guild Pact in play. You are doubly wrong. Please, please.
Yeah, if making Sign of Draco cost two every time and giving out all five of the abilities that it is so kind to grant to others, if that's not enough to make it playable, then it really is not going to make it. The dream is officially dead at that point. I honestly think, though, if you're putting this card in your modern deck, it should almost be aiming higher than that, as weird as that sounds. So if I'm doing this, it's going to be because I'm trying to make the most out of all of like Cabal Coffers and Valakut and all these other things at the same time, and like nick those as well, and Sunken Citadel to work with all of those, and I just have this freakishly bizarre mana base to wrap me into things like, I don't know, the One Ring, Khan, Golos, God knows what else. The mana base is weird enough that with Nick, though, specifically, you can support however big of a commitment to green you like, but then if you don't have the ley line and you're trying to, like, manually do it, or you don't have the Nykthos, excuse me, and you're trying to do this in other ways, like with coffers or whatever, then I think colorless payoffs are the safest at that point. But either way, I think you are aiming higher than just the best, you know, two drop finisher of all time, as well as that sounds.
Okay, I have something to say to you, and I want you to promise me that me saying this will not ruin your Pro Tour testing, and you will not play any of it in Modern until well after that event.
Oh, is it Enchantes?
It's Rhinos Enchantes. You see,
Rhinos
okay,
Enchantes.
So Arteplea is an enchantment, right? You are going to want Leyline Binding in your deck. You put this in your deck. There's no reason to have any cards that are cheaper than three, right? So you're like, you've got the Rhinos Cascade stuff going on, and then you just have the Enchantes stuff layered on top of it.
Hmm. Yeah, I've always wanted to make Enchantes work in Modern, and have not come close recently. I don't know if this is going to be the difference maker there, but it's a delightful thought. So I applaud you for putting that out into the universe, at least. And then in Pioneer, like you can try and revive Mono Green Devotion with this, where just like the curve of this into Nykthos already is incredibly powerful. I've seen comparisons to like Leyland of Abundance being the wrong ban in the first place, and this being like an even less consistent Leyland of Abundance. I think that is kind of inaccurate on several fronts, but once you commit to doing this thing, you're going to lean harder into this thing. So you're going to have like more Invasion of Ixalans plus Oath of Nissus or something. You're going to have more ways to find Nykthos directly, which could be Arcturus Charm, for example. So I think this is one issue that I've seen with people trying to rebuild Mono Green Devotion, is essentially taking that old version of it, taking the four cards out, and then trying to fudge those four slots into something else. Whereas I think you have to rethink every part of it from the ground up once you're moving away from, once you're being forced to move away from Karn necessarily. Like, do you want to be a Storm the Festival deck anymore? Is Cavalier the five drop that you even want? If neither of those things are true, then what about the three drops that are trying to bridge you to there? So yeah, I think you have to really question everything, but something in that space should at least be doable, if maybe not great in the face of the black, red, blue, black squeeze, Anomalia, and God knows what else. Like, Mono Green could just about hedge against all of those at once. I don't know if new Mono Green without Karn can necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to the initial statement I've kept making, is I don't even, you said maybe, I don't trust that old Mono Green would be good still.
Sure, I mean, that was the hypothetical the people brought up, was if they just didn't ban Karn when they did, and you had to play it into the, you know, Geological Appraiser format, and the all this other stuff, like, I guess that they did overlap for exactly the Canadian RC, where some Brave Souls played Mono Green and mostly got the shit kicked out of them. And then no one could play Mono Green anymore because it and Appraiser just got escorted from the building together. But yeah, I think there would be reason to doubt that as well. And Mono Green notably underperformed at the last Pioneer PT when it was really under proper scrutiny. So could well see that happen again. Also, I could see this Leyline fitting into some build of my beloved Enchantes in Pioneer, where having a good Leyline that you can enigmatic into a 5-drop the turn you play it without needing a Fires as well or anything else, like, that's very appealing. It means that any land can always cast Leyline Binding for one mana no matter what, so love that as well. And then if you want to really have cards in all five colors, then you can actually do that now a decent amount of the time, even in your Yorion deck, or maybe it's actually better in Karuga Fires than it is in Yorion Fires, just because you're just going to draw it in your opener more often. But, like, I remember the Xur, the schema, I think it is, from Dominaria United, the Esper one that animates enchantments and gives them lightning and stuff. Well, now, if you have this ley line, you can just cast the Xur and animate the ley line into this like Sign of Draco style creature almost, which is pretty appealing too. So I think there's a lot of cool stuff you can do. I think that is exactly the deck which will get chewed up and spat out by blue-white control, though, which is the main issue. Like, if I was just facing Raddus all day, there's nothing I'd rather play. But if I'm facing blue-white control all day instead, then I might just not register for the tournament in the first place.
Yeah, that all makes sense, that the best place for this card is the deck that was already playing Nylea's Presence.
Yeah, which I don't know if it should have been past a certain point, but given that it was, this is an interesting option to explore in there. So, I don't know. This is just a weird card, and it's kind of a... It has the vibes of a card you'd see on some like custom card forum that gets shot down for being too unrealistic, and yet here it just is in paper, in the flesh. So we'll see what people can do with that. Hopefully I find a good excuse to play it instead of tricking myself into playing it somehow, but we will see. Let's move on to another build around, which I think is being quite heavily overhyped at the moment, and that's Breakout. So this is the Gruul Sorcery, just red-green. Look at the top six cards of your deck. You can reveal a creature, and if it has mana value two or less, you put it onto the board and against haste. And if you didn't, you put it into your hand instead, and then you put the rest of the cards on the bottom at random. So I've seen some pretty bold statements about this card. I've seen people saying that creature combo starts in Gruul in Modern now, which, given that the only playable creature combo deck currently has a double black namesake card, like I'm calling doubt on that one, first of all. But a lot of these shells that people want to put this in, I think, have much bigger problems than just not finding the core combo piece quite often enough. So yeah, this is a natural fit for Devoted Druid in many ways, but it feels like there is a card every 6 months or so that seems like the perfect fit for Devoted Druid, and it has close to zero impact on how playable or in fact unplayable Devoted Druid ends up being.
Yeah, I kind of want to highlight this card because we talked earlier about the difference between 2 and 3 mana, like the mana leak versus make disappear comparison. I think that the difference between the effective 0 mana on when Breakout hits versus like the 1 mana of just casting Traverse or whatever the equivalent is basically nothing almost for a lot of these decks. So like, I don't think the like randomness of Breakout is actually viable. I almost want to liken this to a very like OG Pokemon TCG thing where they printed... There was a card computer search where you could discard 2 cards to tutor for something, and a card called Pokeball where you flipped a coin and tutored for a Pokemon, and guess which one of these cards was really good and which one was really bad. It's not the one that's RNG that was good.
Yeah, and this is, for 2 mana, like 6 cards is a decent amount to dig for, but then if you miss, often that is just game ending right there, because the kind of creature combo deck that wants this card, it wants a very specific card to find with it. And so that really reduces your odds to the point where it's actually not that appealing of a gamble to make with this card anymore. So add that to, you know, the mana difficulties where, like, yeah, you can splash red just for this, but it's not that appealing to do so. I am skeptical of this one, to put it mildly. Also, in a similar space, we have Insidious Ruse. So this is the Golgari Enchantment, black-green. Creature tokens you control have tapped, add 1 mana of any color, and whenever one or more creature cards leave your graveyard, you create a 0/1 plant, and then you put a +1/+1 counter on each plant you control. So already you see visions of this with, like, Underworld Cookbook, Ovaltrace, Daredevil. I've seen mention of it in Yawgmoth, where with the undying creatures, then there's a lot of, like, cool stuff you can do there, and... This plus Yawgmoth plus an undying creature is lethal because the plant can always reset the undying creature. And okay, like, all of that is fine to a point, but did your Yawgmoth deck, which already has more good enablers than it can realistically play, is this one going to get across the line? Or in your cookbook Daredevil deck that already has so many moving parts that don't add up to a whole lot in particular, you don't need yet another piece. The cost 2 mana doesn't do anything by itself and requires these very specific cards to have much of a use there. And even if you do, like, those decks have already been very good at finding some kind of fair fight. They don't need the help there. Where they need the help is against the Living Ends and the Amulets and the combo decks of the world, and this is a slow as molasses engine against all of those. So this is, like, I see why it gets people's gears turning, but I don't think it actually is going to start the car and get you anywhere you need to get.
Yeah, I think that you need to build something completely new for this card to make sense, where, like, there is a specific creature that is repeatedly going out of your grave. Like, you need to make a Thopter Sword with this for it to make sense.
Mm-hmm. So I think that does it for most of the weirdo combo cards or build arounds in the sets, unless you have any others you want to throw in there at this late
stage.
Well,
you missed the last one, which is Chalk Outline. This is the Three in a Green, along the lines of Insidious Roots, this is the one that actually has that Thopter Sword effect. This is the, Three in a Green, whenever one or more creatures leave your graveyard, make a detective, 2/2 blue and white creature token, and then investigate. And this is the one where if you have Oval Chase Daredevil and any way to freely discard it, you just, you know, investigate, get back the Daredevil, this triggers again, you respond, discard the Daredevil, you investigate it, you know, you get that loop. I think that that is in range if there are other ways for creature cards to leave your graveyard. But I don't know. It is a lot to ask for a 4-mana spell to have an impact like that. That's like a 3-card combo. And it may just be hampered by the lack of free discard outlets beyond, like, I don't know, Noose Constrictor level garbage in Pioneer.
You keep Noose Constrictor's name out of your mouth. That card is not garbage, but it just doesn't have the support to work with to make it as broken as it needs to be. In reality, though, yeah, it's like you can build a deck where Chalk Outline is part of some like 3-card infinite loop, but it is doing basically nothing for you outside of that loop, and neither are most of your other combo pieces either. And so, yeah, like, why would I do this instead of basically any other combo deck, or frankly, any other fair deck that operates in a similar space?
Yeah, that's the question that remains to be answered, but its presence there with, like, Daredevil is a card that has created engines in other formats. This is a card that reads like it create other sub-engines with this as the final endgame in the way that, like, you had a Thopter and a Sword in your Urza deck, except for, in this case, it's, like, your Urza and whatever your secondary engine are, that's the full combo. But, like, yeah, I don't quite see how it exactly is supposed to come together, but it's notable that it's relatively close.
Yeah. And then moving on to some of those ostensibly fairer cards, at least. So, Intrude on the Mind, this is the Steam Augury meets Commence the Endgame, if you like. So, it is 5 mana. You split the top 5 cards of your deck into 2 piles. An opponent chooses one. There goes your hand. The other one goes to your bin. And then you get a Thopter with flying with power equal to the number of cards put into your graveyard this way. So the average use case is you get, I guess, 2 cards in your hand and a 3/3 Thopter, or 3 cards in your hand and a 2/2 Thopter, and you get, assuming no successful, like, mind games or sub games with the piles, you get, like, the worst selection from those piles. So I think that formula in the past has always disappointed. Like, Steam Augury itself, of course, like, that card was incredibly overhyped when Theros was previewed back in the day. I think, like, that kind of a Punisher style thing always plays out worse than it you maybe talk yourself into it being on paper. This one, at least, I think in some of the decks that wanted to commence, like, usually these days you see it just as a can't be countered thing for control mirrors, and this doesn't have that, so it's off the table there. But in some deck that is a Torrential Gearhulk deck for whatever reason, then this actually curves pretty nicely into that. And then maybe if you're some, like, Gearhulk creativity deck, maybe this would be the place because it makes a decent creativity target too.
I am not getting tricked into another Steam Augury. I lived through enough of that. We're good on this one, and that's kind of where I'm at.
Okay. Moving swiftly on then, so you've mentioned Undergrowth Recon. This is the 3-mana enchantment that gets a land back from your graveyard every upkeep. I love lands, I love enchantments. I think this card is hideously unplayable, and I'm not even seeing a deck where I could trick myself into being disappointed by this. This card is just garbage, I think. And then Deduce actually is like a subtle roleplay here, which I think will be relevant for creativity decks. This is 1 blue instant, you draw a card and you investigate. So this is a build your own thing twice over time, if you like, but also in Pioneer creativity, you just play this whenever you like. Basically, you get a non-creature creativity target there ready to go, and then, you know, if it's some long, drawn-out, grindy matchup where you want the extra card instead, well, you just take the extra card at your leisure. So I think this is a really nice card in those shells. It does butt up a little bit against stuff like Impulse or whatever, Omen of the Sea, other filtering in that space, but this might just be the best of those given the role that it fills.
I'm, like, just realizing now that this card was printed and Secrets of the Key won a Pro Tour in the last, what, like, year? What the hell?
Yeah, and that
what the
yeah,
hell?
That card is embarrassing, frankly. Yeah. So maybe Reed can run it back with some deduces there instead. But either way, I think this is a natural fit for decks like that. And Pioneer Creativity is in this like weird space at the moment where, since that Pro Tour win, it really hasn't had any finishes to speak of. And yet there are still like four or five different ways that you can convincingly build it, I think. But the context of the format has always changed so much since then that I don't know if any or all of those are actually worth looking at again. So that's going to be one of my side projects for this PT, I think, is just to do quick hits on just creativity in general. And I expect Deduce to be a decent part of that puzzle.
Yeah, that card seems exceptionally powerful in that exact shell. On the topic, well, a card that does not quite work with creativity is Cryptic Cloak. This is the, is it Coat or Cloak? It's Cryptic Coat, my apologies.
Coat.
So this is the equipment that doesn't equip to anything. This is a very weird card. Two and a blue artifact equipment. ETB, cloak the top card of your library and attach this to it. Equipped creature gets +1/+0 and can't be blocked, and then one in a blue, return this to owner's hand. So at a base level, I'm relatively unamused by this card. It's just like a 3-mana 3/2 with 5 to make a 2/2 attached to it. I don't see that seeing play in Constructed. The thing that I think would be interesting about this card to me is to have things that you actually want to cloak, which is the Manifest from this set. You know, puts the card face down and you can turn it up if it's for its mana cost, if it's a creature. Are there cards you have in mind to do that with?
Yeah, it's a bad rate for a weird outcome, but it's weird enough that it gets you thinking. So it's an interesting like infinite mana sink if you have some kind of loop in place already. Like if your deck needs some artifact way of doing that, then it's kind of cool. It is 5 mana in a way that you can like amortize to get an artifact and a creature. E-ing the B, if that's something that you want, like some kind of, or Leaf Spray actually as well. I guess the creature sticks around, which is good, you want it to, but just, this is a way to just endlessly loop something for a decent effect each time, and then if you can unmanifest one of the disguise cards, then sometimes that will be this like big surprise out of nowhere. So yeah, I don't know where this goes, but it's so weird that I thought it was worth at least flagging up, and I'm sure there's something somewhere you can do with it.
Okay, yeah, I am much more skeptical than you.
I guess you can't creativity this per se, but you can like transmogrify it too if that's something weird you want to do. But I mean, there's lots of ways you can do that, but I thought I'd throw that out there at least.
Yeah, I guess on that note of like fair cards you can do weird stuff with, we have Cease Desist. This is the one in a Golgari instant to basically sort of double cremate. So you draw a card, exile 2 cards from a single graveyard, and gain 2 life. I guess it targets a player, but I don't really know when you're making your opponent gain 2 life and draw a card. And then the back half of it is Force, double Selesnya, destroy all artifacts and enchantments. This card instantly enables the Pollen Collect Evidence spell. This is like the whole joke with the split cards in this set is that they're designed to let you just one-shot any Collect Evidence card by being a very expensive card.
Funnily enough, if you're trying to build like a Traverse deck or some kind of Delirium deck instead, then this is 2 card types for that as well.
That's okay. So we've got our card types in graveyard, exile cards from graveyard, double theme deck. I don't think that this lines up the best, but this card does work towards both goals.
Yeah, this is also a cascade compatible form of graveyard hate that like it's mild hate, but it replaces itself, it gives you some other benefits, it's less of a blunt instrument than something like Endurance would be. And if you're fully deranged and you're trying to do this Blood Raid Marauder cascade thing that has picked up some steam on Twitter recently, then I guess there's 2 card types for that as well.
Well, has it picked up steam on Twitter, or have YouTube thumbnails of Anzi D just grabbing his face picked up steam on Twitter?
That may be it. I mean, this might be another perfect example of the internet just collectively rotting all of our brains. But on that happy note, we can move on to some other cards here. So there's Gleaming Geardrake. This is a blue-red for a 1/1 flyer when ETBs you investigate, and when you sacrifice an artifact, you put a +1/+1 counter on this. So at a baseline, it's two artifacts, including a body if you want it, and a non-creature body if you don't. And then I don't know how quickly you're actually loading up counters onto this, but I don't think you can build some cat oven deck where every time you're looping that, you're pumping this up or anything of that nature. But if you have a general interest in making enchantments and then or making artifacts and then binning them, then this is two of those for a pretty decent rate and can sometimes just be big slash big.
Yeah, the fact that it's investigate and not straight up draw a card makes me really skeptical of the rate on this, but I understand where you're, you know, if this is a 2-mana 3/3 that draws a card, that would be very powerful. I just don't know with investigate being a piece of the puzzle there that you ever get to the rate that you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if there were more like lethal demolition style effects in Pioneer, then maybe, or just more baubles, like actual baubles or chromatic stars, spheres, whatever. But I think it falls in that weird gap of it's not quite efficient or strong enough for Modern, but it doesn't have the pieces that it needs to work with in Pioneer. So I'm sure you could build some like cube environment where this card is amazing, or I'm going to confirm its rarity for myself real quick, but okay, it's uncommon. If it was common, then maybe there would be some very silly pauper deck. So in other words, a pauper deck that could use this, but as it is, I think it is just awkward enough everywhere that it has no obvious home.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. The cards that I want to highlight in the 2-drop realm are Undying Gatekeeper and Pyrotechnic Performer. Let's talk about the second one of those last. This is the 2-mana 3/2 that one in a red, and then it has disguise, so pseudomorph, and then flips up for a single red. And whenever it or another creature you control undisguises or turns face up, deal damage equal to that creature's power to, I forget if it's, let me pull this up and if it's any target or opponent. But the thing that's interesting me about this is that, like, it's not the, it's not a good rate. Like, 2-mana 3/2 has been kind of obsoleted in every context. It's just, if you ever have two of these, your opponent dies on the spot. And, like, that feels like a decent upside for a generic red 2-drop. It's probably worse than just a creature with haste. But, like, that little edge alone is enough to make me look at it twice.
Yeah, I do like with a lot of the disguise cards that seem price to move for constructed, that they do have this good buyout of you don't need to disguise them to at least have a reasonable-ish magic card. Like, you don't want to play this as a 2-mana 3/2, but sometimes you'll have to, and that's at least okay. This, you know, even with everything I've said the past few weeks about why 3/2 is such a poor stat line in standard currently, whereas you think back to someone like the Megamorph cards in the past or whatever, the best ones, like, you could play out a turn 2 Den Protector and get frisky with it, but like you really didn't want to if at all possible. These ones, at least, I assume your deck wants to be on the board early anyway, and so this can be part of that recipe.
Yeah, it's marginal, but I'm not exactly sure how marginal it is. The Unyielding Gatekeeper is one that I think just is like a natural fit for a lot of shells. This is a 1-white 3/2, which, again, not a great rate, but it effectively, like, its disguise is 1-white. And when it's turned face up, exile another target non-land permanent. And it's kind of like this split of, like, if it's theirs, it becomes a 2-2. So you have this, like, pseudo-beast within. And if it's yours, you're flickering it. And, like, this is just, like, a 2-drop that kickers into a Banisher Priest. That's really good, I think. And it also can kill Leyline Binding and, like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we think about Skyclave Apparition as this pretty flexible kind of catch-all answer for these creature combo decks, which in the context of if you're having to court for calling for it or something, then the mechanics there do matter, and Gatekeeper can't be that kind of tutorable answer to hate pieces or whatever. But Apparition has always coasted on its flexibility, and when this gets to kill something, it is even more flexible than that. Like, this can trade anything for a 2-2, whether it's like Planeswalker that rises above that threshold, so this can kill 5-mana Teferi, for example, in Pioneer, or kills Leyline Binding, which is a pretty big deal as well. And then likewise, it can save and flicker anything of any mana cost, any type, that you control as well. So you get to, I don't know, flick your own Leyline Binding, or there's a lot of room to for this card to be uniquely good on both sides of that, and then the buyout of either 2-mana 3-2 or just disguise it now, and then you have this kind of in the chamber for later on. Like, all of those modes are actually, like, pretty good for what they are. So, yeah, I'm pretty impressed by this one.
Yeah. The 2-drop that I'm more skeptical of is Sharp-Eyed Rookie. This is the pseudo-evolve creature where you also investigate when a creature with greater power or top... So it's got the evolve text of, like, whenever a creature enters a battlefield under your control with greater power or toughness than this creature's power or toughness, the whole, like, you know, it counts either side, put a counter on it and then investigate. Like, that's sort of attractive on first glance. Like, it also has vigilance, and that's all nice. Until, like, I kind of just directly compared this to Dreadknight and realized that, like, this card has to reliably become a 4-4 on most battlefields for it to be noticeably better than Dreadknight, at which point you do actually have an upside of, like, this creature as a 4-4 would profitably trade for Preacher. But I think that's a fairly big ask when the card doesn't inherently do anything by itself in the end game, in the way that, like, if you just top deck a Dreadknight on, like, turn 7, it's like, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I think cards like this, it almost doesn't matter how good they look. It's just, it feels like the wrong fight to be having a lot of the time. Like, there was it Quirion Beastcaller from DMU? Like, well, one of the better kind of aggressive green 2-drops we've had in quite a long time. And that card, despite, you know, Brian Kibler's best efforts at times, just hopelessly unplayable for the most part. Or it is almost, the better these cards look, the easier it is to be deceived by them. But just, unless they're so powerful that you have to sit up and take notice, they're just not really a good thing to be doing in the first place. And, like, that's the fundamental issue.
I think that if you have a lot of Bonecrusher Giant and Lovestruck Beast that are independently powerful 3-drops that operate on a card advantage scale, but you're looking for something lower on the curve, this card would make some sense. The problem is I just don't think Standard operates at that level right now.
Yeah, so I won't ignore it entirely. Like, I'll file it away for future notice, but I don't expect to be wanting to cast this or too scared to be facing a deck with it in, even if the card itself is good, in the near future. There is a new Krenko, the Krenko Baron of Tin Street, which Sweeney Todd fans can sing that along in a very sing-song way in their head. But in terms of the text on the card itself, this one, was it you who called this out as just being, like, weirdly counterintuitive?
This card makes Goblin players learn how the stack works by itself. It's not like Mog Fanatic, where, like, you can be a smart red player and know how the stack works, but, like, the card largely works the same. No. So it's got 3/3 haste, tap, sack an artifact, put a +1/+1 counter on each goblin you control, and then whenever an artifact you control dies, you may pay red to make a 1/1 goblin with haste. So, like, you have to know that it, like, stacks this, and then when you sacrifice an artifact to it, you make the goblin, and then it's a 2/2, and, like, none of this makes any sense. And also, I don't really know if you're ever going down that road. It's very weird to me that this card exists. And also, like, when you sacrifice a Chromatic Sphere to this, you get the mana, and then the trigger goes on the stack because mana abilities don't use the stack. And, like, this is just a lot of learning for a goblin, and I don't like it.
Yeah, it's... I feel like once you see it in action and you get it, it's like, oh, that's cool, and then you never have to learn it again. But I can imagine, especially, like, a newer Commander crowd just being really, like, tripped up by this one for the first time. It's a neat card, but I think in the context where it's actually going to see any realistic play, some people will get confused by that.
Yeah, my issue is literally that it's just a goblin. Like, that's just not, like, make it a Viashino or something. Yeah. You know, like, they're engineers. Like, this is a card where, like, it signals that you should learn things. Goblin is just not the thing for complicated interactions. This is not how the history of the game works.
I feel like there's been a whole family of, like, especially Goblin Recruiter combo decks, but even just stuff like Goblin Matron, Marxus, where knowing how to do the math and actually calculate probabilities, which is not a common skill for a goblin, but for goblin tamers out there, that's something which they really do need to be acquainted with these days.
Yeah, but all the abilities are on the same card here, as opposed to each individual goblin just, like, doing their job, and then someone gets fired into the cannon and the opponent dies.
Fair enough. So, coming into the home stretch here of just some of the grab bag spoilers to round this out, there's War Leader's Call. This is one white red for an enchantment. Creatures you control get +1/+1, and whenever a creature ETBs under your control, this deals one damage to each opponent. So, trying to think of what kind of deck in, I assume standard is the power level we're pitching this one at, would want this right now. And the Convoke deck that I mentioned having flirted with before, I think, is in that space. And maybe this is a powerful enough incentive that this becomes the thing that you build around. So like this and maybe, you know, Knight Owner of Eos or Adeline or something, and then a bunch of good token makers, your Resolute Reinforcements, this is pretty nice with on both sides. So this, do you think this is enough of an anchor where this is the thing that you're building towards, as opposed to what deck does it fit in already?
I think that this layered with Imodane's Recruiter is the piece that interests me. I don't want to play more than like two of this card in a deck, but once you're at that collective level of explosive game-ending three drop pump your squad things, you have a shell to work with.
Mm-hmm. In a kind of similar space, actually, we did skip over Delny, which was a card that we were both pretty excited about. So this is 2 and a white for a 2/2 legend, human scout. Creatures you control with power 2 or less can't be blocked by creatures with power 3 or greater. So mass skulk effectively. That's not the point here. The point is, if an ability of a creature you control with power 2 or less triggers, that ability triggers an additional time. So even just looking at cards that we've spoken about in the last few minutes, very nice with Resolute Reinforcements, very nice with Imodane's Recruiter, very nice with basically any creature that is not just a vanilla creature that would go in these decks. So even like your Novice Detective or your other one drops, or at its price point in the decks that it goes in, it goes with basically everything, as far as I can tell, which is pretty nice. There might be some weird clash with, if you have the Anthem and now one of your creatures is coming in, it's 3 power instead of 2, then it doesn't double trigger, but you'll figure that out if it comes up. But this is, compared to like the average like Panharmonicon Roaming Throne style effect, like all of those are big hits in a casual context, very occasionally creep into a competitive context, but a lot has to happen for that to go right. But it seems like we at least think this one could get across the line there.
Yeah, the thing that's really interesting about this one, and similarly interesting about Roaming Throne and why that card has been such a big casual hit, is that it's not just ETBs, it's just triggers, like any ability, like attacks, dies, everything. And that scope change is really huge. And I think that this card is like just enough of a better rate that it's not just going to get 4/4 out of existence the way Roaming Throne sort of has in competitive formats. As a 3-drop, it feels like you can piece together a lot more, and it naturally fits with a lot of like the collected company style stuff that would naturally want a 3-drop as opposed to a 4-drop.
Yeah, I think if I'm trying to play with this, I want to be building some kind of engine or doing something that is at least trying to be unfair, because in a more fair creature deck, there's going to be a lot of good 3-drops with just pound for pound that hit a lot harder, do a lot more immediately, whereas I can imagine some kind of creature combo deck where maybe this isn't the focal point, but it's the piece that juices everything else into cards which are just impressive with not too much work, and that being the missing piece in turn that like ties the whole room together.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just very clearly really powerful. I have not figured out, like, there's not like a very obvious like, oh, this is a 3-drop that combos with Basalt Monolith like there was with the blue creature. It's just really powerful on its own, and I haven't figured out exactly how you instantly win the game.
Yeah. And then one final modal removal spell to finish this here. At least for me, you can throw any final candidates into the mix if you like. But this is Pick Your Poison. So this is green for a sorcery. You choose one. Each opponent sacks an artifact, they sack an enchantment, or they sack a creature with flying. So I actually think this is one of the most reliable picks for the entire set to show up in like a lot of sideboards across various different formats. And the reason for that is, I think, each mode can come up quite a lot, and each of those modes is a very good rate for what you're paying for it, especially when if you're doing it so early, often you're getting the exact thing of that type that you want and not the worst one, if that's a thing. So, you know, you can imagine in Modern, you pick a poison against an Urza Saga deck, you're getting their Urza Saga, or maybe their Hardened Scales or their Sagala's Aid, but actually you'll take those two often, a lot of the time. Or the artifact decks are like a little more hit or miss because they tend to flood the board with a lot of artifacts pretty early, but even so, there'll be times where like you have this against Amulet, let's say, where you get either their Urza Saga or their Dryad, depending on the phase of the game, or their Amulet, if they led on that on turn one. And then against decks like your Murktide, for example, the sack a creature with flying mode, we've seen stuff like Broken Wings or whatever show up in the past at the 3-mana point. And this is just efficient enough that you don't feel quite so embarrassed about casting it. And so, yeah, sometimes this snags their Murktide region, but can also, if it gets their 3-3 DLC, if it gets their Ledger Shredder, like, even if that's not what the outcome is that you would love ideally, you paid 1 mana for this. How upset can you really
be? Yeah, I think the card you're thinking of that people put in their sideboards for Murktide for no reason was Runafoul. This is the green target opponent sacks a creature with flying.
That too, yeah.
The thing that actually attracts me to this pick your poison over that in the context of beating Murktide is that there is a spectrum of decks and situations where the Murktide decks actually have, like, a Chalice of the Void or a Relic of Progenitus in their sideboard, and that is a really high impact card. And you have this split functionality of pick your poison where it kills your opponent's Murktide when that is what matters. But realistically, it's the most subsidized way for you to get a disenchant into your deck against their, like, one of in their 15 card sideboard that just nukes your entire strategy.
Yeah, I mean, before people figured out how to register Magus of the Moon in their decks, I'd have been a lot more excited about this in that very familiar role of, well, this is a 1-mana answer to Blood Moon that can also, in a pinch, kill a Dirce, kill a Shredder, kill a Murktide, stuff like that. So, and if they have one of each, I'm not stuck. I get to choose which of those groups I'm selecting from. So, yeah, a phenomenally flexible card for just 1 mana, and I expect this to be maybe not always a good sideboard choice or a worthwhile one, but one that at least makes sense. Like, it covers a lot of bases for a very good rate, and this is price to move. I like this card a lot.
Yeah, it's the kind of card that you put into your, like, deck building box and then you either don't play for a year or it's 1 to 2 of in every single sideboard you play for 3 months.
I like as well that this card, if it was just, I mean, they would never print 1 mana destroy target artifact or destroy target, you know, so on and so forth, but the sacrifice implementation, I like that it punishes people who are dabbling in a little bit of everything or relying too much on one specific artifact or enchantment or whatever. But if you get paired against like an artifact deck or something, maybe at 1 mana this card is still worth it anyway, but there's a little more freedom from the other side in terms of what do I feed to this on the way out. Or, you know, if I'm messing around with Enchantress in Modern and my opponent has this card in their sideboard, they'll bring it in, but they might have to trade it for whatever my first thing is, which in turn lets me decide what is that first thing going to be. Is it worth trying to set that sacrifice up and delaying my development in the process? It feels like you could even be like a dedicated Skies deck and have the same dynamic. Like, you could be leaning hard on one of these angles and not feel like this card was made just to ruin your day in the same way as some of these other sideboard hate.
Yeah, I was going to specifically call out that this card is a good card against enchantments that's bad against enchanties.
Yes, let's go. Okay. I'll sacrifice my, Omen of the Sea or whatever. That's fine.
Yeah, the weirdo card that I want to call out to close things up is Faithlight. This might just be like a card that is absolutely unbeatable and limited that never crosses into Constructed. This is the one in a blue. It's the typical, like, 2-mana flash aura that grants hexproof until end of turn and some ability, but the ability is +1/+2 and flying on this card. And, like, the card being halfway between a one with the wind and a dive down is, like, really interesting, even if it's at the bad cost for a dive down. I don't think this crosses the line, but it's just, you know, similar to Reasonable Doubt. It's just one of those things where you just stop and are like, that's a costing and mix of effects that is really interesting.
Yeah, that dozens long list of like eligible auras for light pours or whatever just got like 1 or 2 cards longer. So I will fire that one away for future notice. Have to say though, I think those decks in Pioneer currently, like back when mono green was a deck with the big target, those decks made a lot of sense. They feasted on mono green. Now that the most popular decks are Rakdos and blue white with four temporary lockdown, maybe not so much.
Yeah. Temporary lockdown, a pretty big problem for the generic Bogle strategy.
Yes. So on that happy note, we can move away from talking and speculating about this set, where I think both before talking about it and after going so long on it too, our verdict is I don't think there are any like obvious standouts which are going to revolutionize any particular format outside of, you know, you hope any set is going to change standard to some degree, but there's just a lot of like cool-ish stuff going on that you hope to see show up in various places.
Yeah, that's about right. I don't want to use the word Oko, but there's not like an Oko level like standout, this is broken, we should all put this card on rate into our decks card, and I'm happy to see a bunch of things that make me think and not that.
Yes. So even the stuff like the Mana Leak, which I think will have a big impact in Pioneer, that almost feels like it's overdue in the sense of course, in a format like that large, the control deck of choice is going to have a Mana Leak, and not that this is crossing some new frontier of card design that is, that is leading to runaway power creep, or the game just looks so much different now. It's like, no, this is just... Well, here's your Mana Leak, finally, after a dozen years.
Yeah, everyone else is allowed to play with Fable of the Mirror Breaker. Please let the control players do something.
Although not too much, and I worry that that's kind of the territory that we're getting into before long. But in any case, we can move away from that for now and get into a quick look at the results from the regional championship in Ghent this past weekend. So we are firmly in the thick of this round of modern regional championships, and Ghent was the test run, if you like, for the other ones to come. And going into that, it seemed like Modern was more condensed, more solved, and more, again, like stable or stale, depending on your view of things, than it has been in quite a while here. And I was hoping that some of Europe's finest, you know, the John Emmanuel Duprazes and Mark Tobiasz of the world would dazzle us with something new here. And mostly they didn't really do that. So what we thought coming in was kind of what we thought coming out of it. And it feels like we are in the Modern Horizons 3 waiting room era of Modern for the next few months. But you could go back and compare that to the Modern Horizons 2 waiting room era. This one seems a lot better, and it seems a lot better mostly because of a lot of the stuff in MH2. So on that front, you can look back on that set mostly as a success, I think. And this current snapshot of Modern, it doesn't thrill me. I don't think there's too much new to talk about or think about. But in terms of playing the games, like, I think it's a perfectly fine format.
Yeah, I still have not gotten around to figuring out why Yawgmoth is good, but it did have basically the best performance this last weekend. I think technically Creativity might have put up better numbers, but like Yawgmoth actually put up the like numbers in terms of like first place, second place kind of finishes.
Yeah, don't tell the Creativity Cobras that. That's very much a don't try this at home kind of situation there. But I think the big like top line story with Yawgmoth is that the Fury ban actually did have a pretty big effect on the format, where I think there was this overcorrection in the narrative coming out of course, the most hilarious outcome after the ban of that first LMS event scam without Fury just winning the whole thing. I think we overcorrected from Fury is the problem, which a lot of people contested even at the time, to actually the Fury ban changed nothing. It was just a flesh wound. They should have banned Grief instead, and now the format is just the same as ever. I think Scam as a deck got a lot worse without Fury, and that's borne out in Scam's results this past weekend, at least in Europe. It cleaned up in Brazil, but that's a much smaller tournament where a lot of the better players were just playing the same Scam list. So, yeah, I think you can take that one with a grain of salt, maybe. But yeah, across the board, Scam just got a lot worse. And I think that was apparent to people who actually tested the deck and took it seriously, instead of just, you know, copying the same list from the online results, which then those lists, which were the same list, became copied again, and so on and so forth. Like, I think this was a fairly predictable thing to see coming, and not to get the plug in too soon, but patrons would have seen that prediction ahead of time already. But I think the story is basically Scam went from being the top deck by far and the worst matchup for Yawgmoth to still one of the top decks and actually a pretty good matchup for Yawgmoth, so that helped a lot. And then with the rest of the format kind of condensing around that, like Murktide picking up again. I think now that is an actively good matchup for Yawgmoth instead of a pretty close one. And then Living End, the consensus seems to be that Yawgmoth starts behind there, and I can believe that. But I think if you care enough about the matchup, you can make it really good. And that's kind of how I feel about the Yawgmoth versus Amulet matchup as well. And then that really only leaves Rhinos as like the sore point among the top tier decks. And it's no coincidence, I think, that with Scam being so popular and doing so badly, and Yawgmoth doing so well, Rhinos as a deck which is meant to beat up on both of those had a phenomenal weekend in its own right. So along with like Murktide underperforming. So among that top tier, I feel like the results of this weekend were kind of validating for everything that you could have concluded if you thought about it coming in.
Yeah, and I do like to see the Rhinos decks like gradually moving towards main deck dismember, upping the cheap card count, trimming down on the like piles of Flame of Anor and Tidebinders that were in the older lists and like sneaking down the curve. But yeah, this outcome for the format largely makes sense, aside from the fact that it feels like every single deck in the format is like a little bit not good in ways that are like, none of the decks feel good, but also nothing beats the good decks. It's very weird.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why you saw so much confusion, grumbling, just agonizing over what to pick for this tournament, because there was no obvious standout deck. Each of the top tier decks, which is generally good, has a glaring weakness to at least one of the other very good decks. And so it felt very hard to get an edge. And if you already felt confident and experienced with one of those decks, you could lock that in and mostly be okay with things. But if you didn't, it was really hard to know how to crack into that. And it also felt like the format was quite hard to exploit there from the outside. So I think next week or before the next RCs, we will go a little bit further into, you know, what would our picks be on both a deck choice level and a card choice level? Are there ways to kind of get an edge here? Are there some choices on the fringes that might be good bets if you're willing to roll the dice? But for now, we knew what the top tier was coming in, and mostly that has held up. And you can revise Scam and Merc downwards and Jorg and Rhinos up, and I would expect that to be reflected in the next batch of results in Denver, in Ottawa. But for the most part, it's the top five or six-ish decks were known coming in. They're the same now, and I don't see that really changing ahead of MH3 in a few months.
Yeah, I am in a similar boat of, it's going to take a lot to destabilize this, and I don't think the cards that are going to do it will exist in sets other than MH3.
Yeah, which I was looking forward to anyway, but I think I'm ready for a change, and I cannot wait for MH3 spoilers and hype to start consuming us all in earnest. Until then, though, I think that's going to do it for the MKM spoilers for now, and for our modern analysis for now, too. So more of both of those in the Discord in the meantime, of course. Feel free to ask us questions in there. But in terms of our nonsense of the week, we have a few weird things to highlight this week as well.
Well, if you're stuck in the modern waiting room, can I interest you in a format that was created today called Niles Bat Heist? I think maybe yesterday, but this was, I believe, Commander player, well-known streamer and content producer, Niall Joan Rivers on Twitter, created a format called Niles Bat Heist, where you go on Arena and you join the best of one queues with a deck that is 56 basic lands and 4 deep cavern bats. And whenever you exile a card from your opponent's hand with a deep cavern bat, you can add that card to your deck in future games. You can change the basic lands that are in your deck over the games you play, but you must always have 4 bats in your deck. And your goal is to go until you win one game. And it is somewhat of, it's like, I don't know, it's got like some Chandelar vibes, some like Playing for Anti vibes, some like Nuzlocke Pokemon vibes. People have been sort of speedrunning it with a timer. And I think this is just a beautiful thing to start the year off with.
Yeah, is when all of the constructed formats are either kind of ossified for now, or in such a state of flux that we don't really have too much to say until we actually get to sit down and play with the cards. Little subquests like this are really the best diversion to occupy you.
Yeah, I don't know why this is so like awesome and attractive to me, but like this is just the coolest thing ever. Like the decks that you like, it's exactly what you'd expect people are winning with, where it's like they have selected a lot of low drops and shieldreds out of their opponent's hands and, like, are just trying to curve out one game. But it's just the highs and lows of, like, people drawing their second bat in a game and getting excited because they have thrown their second Pokeball and caught another, I guess, our pals, Pokemon, whatever we're calling them these days, from their opponent's deck to play the next game. Just a real delight.
I mean, you could also reintroduce the actual anti-component of it, too. Like, if you you take the cards with the bat, and then if you win, you get the actual physical cards that you took with the bat, and then you get to build out your deck from there.
Yeah, the problem with Arena is that you just kind of have to claim that's what you're doing, and then trust that your opponents with no communication are playing by those rules. Don't really know if that's how it works. Maybe this is a form of piracy, where, like, you're generating an additional copy of digital content without destroying the original. I don't know. It's just good vibes all around.
You wouldn't steal a Shieldred, or, well, maybe you would, actually. That's the whole point of this. Yeah, I guess anti-functionality on Arena is probably a few years out, given everything else that they have maybe not even tried and failed to implement over the past few years that very easily could or should be there by now. But in any case, in the meantime, we have to reinvent that thrill in our own ways, and it sounds like they've done that pretty well.
Yeah, delightful format, delightful things. Glad to see that happen before we can get around to actually playing with some of the cards that we have spent this entire episode discussing.
Yes, and so until then, you can find us over in the Discord, along with many other, goblin and other creature type enthusiasts. Lots of chatter going on in there. You can find our content over at SEG and not CFB/TCG player anymore, respectively. I'll let you fill in the gaps on that one.
Yeah, so Channel Fireball has condensed so that I believe it is only their in-house people creating content for them, which means that I have been writing Magic content for 14 years and am actually going to try to take a dedicated break from writing for the time being, which probably means that what will happen is I will be inspired to write something and it will probably end up on the podcast Patreon, but I largely do not want to commit myself to a schedule, so I don't want to, like, have my own Patreon or anything like that going. Just, like, if there is something interesting, expect it to show up on the podcast Patreon, but when that happens, it's going to be hard to say.
Yeah, there's no shame at all in that kind of regular writing around editors or other people, but I don't know, there's something just kind of special about, like, writing what you want to write when you want to write it. But for the people out there who are trying to make more of a, like, structured thing out of it, like, those opportunities are fewer and further between than ever. As much as I say here every week that you can find my stuff over on SEG, it's like, well, you can only find my stuff, and I'm pretty sure that will end the moment that they, like, remember I exist or work factor that into their accounting at some point. So not taking that for granted in the long term by any means. But if you do want some more regular content out there as well, I do have my own Patreon focusing on various constructed formats that was launched last week and will be going in earnest over the next few months. So right now you can find a in-depth 4,500 word guide to standard Slowgurk pre-rotation, a real love letter to that deck, along with my modern predictions heading into this round of RCs, which I think were mostly borne out, and also my my guide and list and cyborg guide for all of the amulet perverts out there who want to join our numbers. So expect a lot more stuff in that space, and with we'll have to be somewhat mute about Pioneer heading into the PT, but expect a lot of standard and modern over the next few weeks. And then, you know, have been having a lot of fun brewing Legacy decks recently, so probably some free content for stuff there. Just a little bit of everything for the fans, for the people at home. So we will link to all of that from both of us in the show notes, and link to all of the other stuff that we've mentioned here along as well. But until then, and until next time, take care, everyone.